Thank you all for coming. Last night we had 536 people present. It was a wonderful town meeting. My name is Myron Fox, and it's my privilege to be your moderator tonight. I declare a quorum present. Coffee and snacks are provided this evening by the Lincoln Sudbury Culinary Group. They cook, bake, and fundraise for charity. Just a reminder to everyone to please turn off your cell phones now. And we had a little problem last night of when you speak into the mic, hold it fairly close and speak at a good volume. We couldn't get the name and address, and the town clerk has to keep an accurate record of everyone who speaks and makes a motion, etc. So try and speak loudly and clearly into the mic, particularly when you start by giving your name and address. If you desire to be recognized, please raise your card from your seat. Do not stand at the standing mics. After you're recognized, please stand so one of the runners will know where you are and can bring you a mic. Also, when you receive the mic from the Boy Scout runner, it will be on. There's no need to blow into it. Our thanks go out to Boy Scout Troop 63, who are tonight's runners. I think we have tonight, is Isaac Feldberg here? Right there. Am I right? Raise your hand, Isaac. All right. Leif Scramstead is right next to him. And I hope over here we have Ryan. And who's with you there, Ryan?
Mark.
Thank you very much. And while we're thanking Boy Scouts, I misspoke last night. It is Boy Scout Troop 61 that delivered your warrants that hopefully you have in your hands. So we thank them. To the extent that you don't have your warrant in your hand, we have plenty up here. All motions to amend must be delivered to me, the town clerk, and the folks at the ViewGraph in writing before they're made to the hall. Only registered voters of the town and non-registered town employees may speak without leave of the hall. Non-residents are required to sit in the last two rows to the left or the right. Unless you move in the words of the article as printed in the warrant, every presenter must tell the hall of any word changes in the motion and how they differ from the words that appear in the warrant that the voters have seen. Just a brief reminder, crowd last night was great. No hissing, booing, whistling, clapping, or the like, whether you're in favor or against something, before, during, or after the time someone is speaking. Speakers may not make disrespectful remarks, whether they're directed at a speaker, a presenter, or a town official. I'm encouraged those of you who don't speak very often at town meeting, please raise your cards. We'd be delighted to hear from you. I'm now continuing a tradition that we started at the 2006 annual town meeting by expanding our sense of community here at the 2008 annual town meeting. We can do this again by honoring our own. Two people who are particularly related to this august legislative body. Tonight, we are honoring a husband and wife team who have been married for almost four decades. Frank and Ursula Lyons, would you please come up front? And you haven't even heard yet what they've done. Ursula has served on the following committees: Sewer Assessment Study, Citizens Advisory Committee, 2003 to the present; Metro West Water Supply Protection Committee, 1990; Hop Brook Pond Study Committee, 1998 to the committee was dissolved in May of 2005; Planning Board, elected member, 1991 to 1996; Strategic Planning Committee, 1996 to 2002; Election Worker, from 2001 to the present. Not to be outdone, Frank Lyons, for many, many years, has been on the Hop Brook Protection Association. As president, he was instrumental in getting Marlboro to begin to clean up the pollution that the city was putting into Hop Brook. This took many years of pushing the federal EPA to help us to do this, and he got it done. He was also the leading proponent of maintaining five-acre zoning in the Wayside Inn Historic District in the 1990s. Frank and Ursula, a longtime residents in town meeting, ever since they moved here in 1969. I'd like you to help me thank Frank and Ursula Lyons for all their work. I was asked to remind you of the materials concerning warrant articles that are out on the tables as you came in, where you checked in tonight. Anybody who needs a warrant, as I said, there's one right in front of me. There's a bunch of them. Bathrooms are across the hall from the auditorium. Emergency fire exits, two at the back and two at the front. Feel free to, in an emergency, to come through these stairways and go behind the stage. And we'll now take up Article 21. I obviously have a personal interest in this article, so I will not preside on this. Instead, I've asked Assistant Town Moderator Fred Pryor to preside on this issue.
So you didn't know you had an Assistant Town Moderator. Actually, I've been coming to town meeting for a long time, and I don't remember an assistant town moderator ever coming up here. But let's do Article 21. Mr. Kablak for the motion, please.
Good evening. I move in the words of the article.
Is there a second? There's a second. Presentation, please.
Thank you. This is a petitioner's article. I am one of the petitioners who signed the article. This is a procedural change to the town's bylaws. It proposes to amend the bylaws, changing the term of the town moderator position from a one-year term to a three-year term. For many, many years, a town moderator was elected at the beginning of each town meeting and basically served for the term of that town meeting. And that is the genesis of the one-year term for moderators throughout the state. In 1943, the state legislature amended the statutes and allowed town moderator positions to be either a one-year term or a three-year term. Since 1943, a little bit more than half of the towns throughout the Commonwealth have made the change that I am proposing tonight. The reason for the change is that the position of a town moderator in this day and age is a much more complicated one than its original position. It is one that is encumbered with many sets of rules and procedures, and the difficulties associated with that, it is my belief, lend themselves to a longer term of office, a longer term so that a moderator can make use of the customs and practices of a town meeting and put those to use over a multiple term. The town moderator position currently is the only elected office in this town that serves for 1 year. All of the other elected offices serve for multiple years. And for that reason, the proposed change would also bring the town moderator position in line with other elected positions in the town. Now, some might say that the multiple term of office might chill one's interest in becoming a town moderator. And I would respond to that by saying that over many years, we have had the good fortune in this town of town moderators who have served for many one-year terms. And so I don't think in this particular case in the town of Sudbury that it would chill interest in the position running forward. It's a procedural change. It's not a moneyed article. I don't present it as a controversial article. And I urge your support tonight.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Kablak. Finance Committee, comment, please.
The Finance Committee takes no position on this article.
Mr. Keller of the Selectmen.
The Selectmen unanimously support this motion, this article. It seems to us to be an appropriate change to the procedures for running our town government.
Thank you. All those who would like to speak, please raise your cards. I see absolutely no one. Yes. Where are you? Go right ahead. Go right ahead. Name and address, please.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. And this ain't broke. The moderator does not need a three-year term, and because we now can is not a sufficient reason for making an unnecessary change. I remind you that the moderator is the one town official who is most directly responsible for ensuring that the people's will is heard. And a longer term is very much unlikely to make the moderator more responsible to the people. The moderator doesn't need a longer term because he is in danger of being defeated, no matter how complicated the job has become. In the 38 years that I have been in Sudbury, we've had four moderators. And I think only one of them was actually defeated for re-election. It's an inconvenient fact that moderators have been known to become more arrogant and high-handed as time goes on and they serve more and more terms. I don't think there's any reason to suppose that the present incumbent would fit that profile. He's certainly shown no sign of it so far. But I think certainly we can remember that there have been moderators who have, over time, lost some of the support of the people that elected them. And electing a moderator every year is a good way to guard against that. The only reason that I can see, the only substantive reason for passing this change is to make it so that the moderator only has to get signatures for a re-election petition in 1 year out of three. Now, if you think that that's the most important thing, if the convenience of the moderator is the most important issue, then I suppose that it makes just as good sense to go ahead and vote for this. But if other than that, there is no reason that Mr. Kablak presented that requires this change or even militates in favor of this change. Full disclosure, I'm the moderator of the Sudbury Water District. I have been for in excess of 20 years, I'm now told, and I serve for a one-year term.
Thank you, Mr. Coe. Anybody else wish to be heard? In the back, way, way, way back over there. We have a microphone.
Ralph Tyler, 1 Deacon Lane. I'd like to sort of second Mr. Coe's comments. I think that it's not broken. We don't need to fix it. I'm particularly worried that with the moderator having the appointive power for the Finance Committee, that over a three-year period of term, we might at some future date elect a moderator who is out of touch with the will of people. And over that three-year term, could fully staff the Finance Committee to the detriment of the townsfolk. And so I say that, in fact, it's better that we have a one-year term to avoid that possibility. And I might even suggest that we might even be better served as a community for many of our other boards to be at one-year terms. Because I think that many of the townsfolk this year demonstrated that a number of our town elected officials were out of step with the community. And perhaps this might have been a year for a general house cleaning had we had shorter terms. So I think, in fact, if there's anything, we should admire the fact that we have a one-year term for a moderator and question why more of our offices aren't one-year terms. Thank you.
Is there anybody else wishing to be heard? Over here in the red.
I'm Howell, 1 Knobscott Road. I agree that the one-year term doesn't seem to be costing us anything. It doesn't seem to be an undue burden on the town. We have an annual election anyway, and I think that there doesn't seem to be a problem, and there doesn't seem to be a compelling reason to change it.
Anybody else? Right here in the front.
Robert Abrams, 24 Goodman's Hill Road. I find it discouraging when I go to the town election every year that rarely, if ever, is there a contested office in this town. I've only been here 36 years, so I I have seen the same four moderators that Mr. Coe has. And we're fortunate to have moderators serve for a long time because it's a hard job. But based on the comments I'm hearing tonight, perhaps it would be better for all of us if the moderator did have a three-year term, so that if somebody had any concern about it, maybe there'd actually be a contested office from time to time.
Down here in the front.
Steve Gabler, 28 Mossman Road. And I've lived here 33 years, and I've seen three moderators. And I think they've all three done a very good job. They've served for many years. They've been reelected every year on a yearly basis in a town election that we have every year, whether a moderator is running or not. By and large, they've run unopposed. But I don't see any benefit to the three-year term. I'd just as soon let the moderator know they're doing a good job on a yearly basis.
Thank you. Anybody else? Are we ready to vote on this motion? This is a majority vote. All those in favor, please raise your cards. All those opposed, it clearly passes to me. Thank you.
Now move on to Article 22. We have Deborah Deneen from the Conservation Commission. Are you the motion maker on Article 22?
Conservation coordinator and a resident at 14 Firecut Lane. I move in the words of the article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Ms. Deneen.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Article 22, as you may have read in your warrant, seeks to establish a speed limit on the Sudbury River. Sounds strange? It is. And this is how it came about, and this is why we're asking for it. The center of the Sudbury River serves as the town boundary between the towns of Sudbury and Wayland. Wayland Town Meeting adopted a 10-mile-an-hour speed limit on their half of the waterway quite a few years ago. Sudbury has never set a speed limit on the river. The river is currently patrolled by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they're more than willing to patrol it if they can patrol it effectively. Right now, if somebody's on the Wayland half of the waterway, they can stop them. If they happen to paddle their canoe or their kayak, or not that they'd go that fast, but they're and I can go fast, I can't go 10 miles an hour. If they go over to the Sudbury side, there's nothing that the law enforcement people from Fish and Wildlife can do about it. So Fish and Wildlife actually approached the town and offered to patrol the entire river in Sudbury, provided we adopted the same speed limit as Wayland, so they weren't out there just burning gas, trying to keep people on one side of the river. So, this will not cost the town a cent. If anything, it will keep the river safer. Some of you who maybe go out on the river with your canoes and your kayaks, the Sudbury River being very windy, you can sort of tootle over to one side of the river to look at what may be on the bank over there, and then you get a motorboat that comes around a blind corner. Having a speed limit isn't just the right thing to do from an enforcement standpoint, but it's also a right thing to do from a safety issue now that more and more people are discovering that wonderful resource. Thank you.
Please. Ralph Verney, Finance Committee.
Finance Committee recommends approval.
Selectman.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator.
Board of Selectmen have unanimous approval. That's unanimous approval by the Board of Selectmen. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 22? Yes, gentleman over there. Please stand up, sir.
Yeah, my name is Kurt Larson, 95 Water Row. And unlike most of you fellow residents, I actually live on the Sudbury River. This to me seems like just excess unwarranted regulation for something where there is no real problem. I would like to ask the petitioner if the town does have a contract or perpetual agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to affect the enforcement of the speed limit, or is this something where a future administrator for the refuge could choose not to enforce it, perhaps because their budget is being constricted?
Yes. Mr. Neen?
Yes, thank you. That is an excellent question. At the present time, we do not have a contract with U.S. Fish and Wildlife. However, the first step in getting that contract in place is to bring the vote before the voters. There's no point in spending town staff resources and Fish and Wildlife staff resources to develop a contract until we know that the town is in favor of it. Thank you. But the intent is yes, there will be.
But the answer to my question is no, correct?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
The question is, do we have a perpetual agreement or contract with the Fish and Wildlife Service to enforce the speed limit?
We don't at this point, no.
Okay.
Thank you.
So if at some time in the future they don't enforce it, we're stuck enforcing it at the town level. And we need another police officer and a boat and another article to fund that in the future. It just seems like unnecessary burden and a future expenditure for the town, which we are not prepared to raise the levy for. Thank you.
Ms. Deneen, you can't answer?
Yeah. As far as the speed limit and future enforcement, if we were ever in a position where we couldn't enforce it, it could come back to town meeting to be abolished if that became the case.
Thank you. There's a gentleman right behind there. Could you give him the mic?
Graham Taylor, 221 Goodmans Hill Road. I'm clearly in favor of this. Uniformity just seems obvious. But I think the geography needs to be corrected. Sudbury side is the west side of the river, not the east side.
Okay. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 22? I see someone right there. Please stand.
Levin Birchwood Avenue.
Could you repeat your name? The mic wasn't on.
Paul Wojda, 11 Birchwood Avenue.
Thank you.
If, in fact, it would be enforced, do we have an idea about the budget for that in the future? Second, how will it be enforced, as in posting, notifications, signage?
Ms. Deneen, do you have an answer?
Yes, another excellent question. The Fish and Wildlife Service will post rules on their property. We have the ability as a town, if you vote for this, to post the speed limit as well. So, yes, it will be posted, and it will be enforced by the Fish and Wildlife Service being able to write tickets.
Thank you. Anybody?
Oh, question. At what cost, ma'am, for the posting?
For posting the signs? Well, I know from ordering Conservation Commission signs, when you get big signs and you have them made up in over six signs, the signs are generally $20 to $30 a piece.
Thank you. Anybody? Yes, gentleman on the aisle.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. I think the first thing that we need to do is to actually read this article. Note that the Conservation Commission report says that the article is for the establishment of a bylaw which will set a 10-mile-per-hour maximum speed limit. But the fact of the matter is that this article goes well beyond that. Just a few points to point out. I'll just read through them and say what I think they mean, and then see if somebody wants to challenge my interpretation. No motorboat shall be operated upon any portion of the Sudbury River or its tributaries. Now, and then it goes on to say what will happen. You know, can't endanger public safety and so on. Now, as I read that, the regulations will apply to virtually all lakes and ponds in Sudbury because they're all on tributaries of the Sudbury River. Later in Section C, it says, the town may join with any other town through which said Sudbury River or any of its tributaries flows, or a government agency in the enforcement of this bylaw, or a similar bylaw adopted by such other town. Now, does this mean that a bylaw adopted by Wayland will be enforceable in Sudbury? I don't see anything that says it wouldn't. And it also seems to say that the Fish and Wildlife Service and or the Wayland or Marlboro Police could enforce these regulations on any pond in Sudbury that's on a tributary of the Sudbury River, and we might have to pay them to do it. Now, another thing is in the Conservation Commission report, the statement that the town boundary between Wayland and Sudbury is the center line of the Sudbury River is simply factually incorrect. It's true for part of the boundary, but for a large part of the boundary, the river is entirely in Wayland. So it's certainly not the case that all up and down the Sudbury River, they have to worry about which side of the river a speeder is on. I don't have any problem with the 10-mile-an-hour speed limit, but other things like at an unreasonable rate of speed. What unreasonable rate of speed is less than 10 miles an hour? In a noisy or obnoxious manner, who decides that? By a motor not having an underwater exhaust, is that a new requirement? That certainly has nothing to do with a 10-mile-an-hour speed limit. I just submit that this article, however well-intentioned it may be, is simply not ready for prime time.
Thank you. Ms. Deneen, could you, your answer should be restricted to what he said about the motion, not the report. Okay?
Yes, thank you. All of the town maps show the river as the center line of the river as being the boundary. There might be some maps out there that don't show that. I can't vouch either way. Maybe the town engineer has some information on that. As far as the motors underwater, as far as operating any kind of power boats on waterways that are tributaries to the Sudbury River, the way it's worded, that's the way it appears to be, and I will defer to town council for that interpretation. However, if that is the case, wouldn't we want this to apply to all of our waterways, to make all of our waterways as safe as can be? Thank you.
Town Council?
Mr. Moderator, I can answer a couple of these questions. The speed limit at 10 miles an hour would be a maximum speed limit. And I think Mr. Dean addressed the unreasonable rate of speed when she talked about people in canoes or something. So if someone was coming by at less than 10 miles an hour but could leave enough of a wake to swamp a canoe, so you have to, in order to provide for that, you can't necessarily say you can only go 2 miles an hour because that would probably be unreasonable. So it was, but the maximum was set at 10. And the unreasonable rate of speed would be when you're passing someone or doing something of that nature. I'm also going to, it's my understanding that the underwater exhaust was for pollution type reasons. And obviously there are some questions with regard to the whether or not this is a good idea as a bylaw are concerned, and I can't address those, but strictly from a legal standpoint, I think that the provisions in here are, in fact, enforceable from strictly from a legal standpoint.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 22? Yeah. No. Yes.
A follow-up question because
that's not a point of order, Mr. Coe. Well, Mr. Coe, you know that's not a point of order. If you'll sit down, I'll call on you in a minute. Let's give someone else a chance to talk. Yes, in the middle, please. Right there, ma'am. Stand up, please. No, you have to wait for a mic. We don't get the record if... Thank you. No.
Ask my husband. Joanne Topham, 210 Concord Road.
Having been someone in a canoe who had a motorboat go flying by them and swamp our canoe and flip it over and left us there on our own to drown, I completely support this article. It's well overdue and it's well needed, regardless of where the river goes and where its tributaries end up. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 22? Yes, right over here. Can you stand up, please?
Kerry Lynn, 164 Maynard Farm Road.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Kerry Lynn.
Thank you.
The article talks about the ability of the town to appropriate funds to enforce this, presumably on all the tributaries as well, but there's no financial impact statement here. So I would really like to have some sort of boundaries put on this before we... I mean, we're in a mode now where we're firing teachers because we can't pay for them. And so I'd really like to hear about the financial impact of this going forward.
Okay. Do we have someone who can address the financial impact of this article?
Yes. Mr. Moderator, the financial impact would not be addressed until a request for an appropriation is made to this body. So if there's going to be an appropriation, town meeting is the only body that can make that appropriation.
Thank you. Yes, all the way in the back, please.
Hi, Bob Capaccio, 337 Hudson Road. I'm a resident of the town for 30 years, and one of the opinions I just wanted to render on the fact about the motors with the exhaust below the waterline, the smaller boats typically have smaller horsepower engines or motors. And they're two-cycle motors, and a two-cycle motor, if you know, it burns gasoline mixed with oil, something similar to the old lawn mowers. So what's happening is the gasoline as well as the oil, as it's combusted, it's partially combusted, it's going to go into the waterway and create a little bit more pollution. So I think not only because of the safety of the canoers and light, it's also the pollution of the waterways. I think we should pass this motion.
Thank you. Mr. Coe.
Mr. Moderator, since the proposition has been made that, notwithstanding my previous remarks, the center line of the Sudbury River really is the boundary, I would like to know how the Conservation Commission explains the fact that for three of the four crossings from Sudbury into Wayland over the Sudbury River, both ends of the bridge are in Wayland. That's true in Route 27, it's true on Route 20, and it's true on Pelham Island Road. The only bridge that has even one end of it in Sudbury is Sherman's Bridge. And anybody who wants to put a map up on the board will see that.
Yes, Ms. Deneen.
Thank you, Mr. Coe. I appreciate that, and I stand corrected. I did check with the town engineer, and he did correct me that south of Route 27, the center line of the brook is not the boundary, that more of the river is in Wayland, south of Route 27. Thank you, Mr. Coe, for correcting that.
Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, over here, please.
Steve Guthers, 69 Wagon Wheel Road. I've been in town for 14 years. I do a lot of kayaking on the Sudbury River, and I believe very strongly in the pristine nature of the river. The last thing that I would like to see, and I assume a lot of other kayakers, are signs, mile-per-hour signs on the river, and a federal agency boat, motorboat, looking up and down the river, or motoring up and down the river, checking other boaters. With all due respect to the woman who had the bad accident, as I say, I've done a lot of kayaking, and the few motorboats that I have experienced have been very respectful when they have passed me on the river. So I would respectfully ask people to vote against the measure.
Thank you. This gentleman right here in front row.
Steve Gabler, 28 Mossman Road. I've been canoeing on the Sudbury River for 33 years. Among other rivers. And most of the time, motorboaters are courteous. There's a certain etiquette of the water between powered boats and unpowered boats. But I have on quite a few occasions had people in motorboats going as fast as the boat would go and paying no attention to other than missing other boats. And whether the... So I would like to see the ability to control those rare occurrences. In terms of where the boundary of the river is, I don't think it's too relevant that some of the boundary is not in the center of the river. The what's important is that some of the river is in Sudbury. And the great deal of the river is in a national wildlife refuge. Part of the reason for controlling the speed of boats is to protect the nests of birds that are nesting in very shallow banks. The Fish and Wildlife Service cannot enforce a speed limit unless it's uniform on the entire river. Sudbury appears to be the last piece of the river that has no regulation, and so they can't enforce it anywhere. If we pass this, Fish and Wildlife is perfectly willing to enforce it on the entire river, and this would give them the ability to do so. I urge you to vote in favor of this.
Thank you. The question's been called. Is it seconded? It has. All those in favor of the call of the question signify by raising your hands. All those opposed? It's well more than two-thirds. We're now going to move on to the vote on Article 22. Before we do, however, I'm going to ask, because we have a fair amount of people standing, if you are a Sudbury voter, I'm going to ask you to take a seat. And before I do, I'm going to ask all of those of you who have empty seats next to them, please stand and raise your cards. People who are standing, please go to those seats in order us to get an appropriate count. Thank you so much. Keep standing. And while we're waiting, I'd like to announce that we missed recognizing two folks at last night's meeting. The director of assessing is Maureen Hafner. Raise your hand, please. And also missing from the list of Lincoln Sudbury graduates who are now serving in the military is Captain Brian Mahoney. Thank you. Anybody else who doesn't have a seat? We'll be voting in one moment. Again, could you just raise your cards if you have an empty seat next to you? The people fill in and come to those seats. That's terrific. Thank you so much.
Hopefully, the countries also support ours.
Thank you. We're ready for a vote on Article 22. All those who are in favor of Article 22 signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it passes by well more than a majority. Article 23. John Drabinski for a motion.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Move in the words of the article.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Drabinski.
Thank you again, Mr. Moderator. Although the state regulations promulgated by the Department of Public Safety and the Division of Occupational Safety under 520 CMR 14 excavation, trench, and safety do not go into effect until January 2009, towns are required by Massachusetts General Law, Chapter 82, to establish a process to appoint a permitting official to set fees for the excavation of certain trenches within a municipality. This addition to the town bylaw provides the town manager the ability to set the fees and to appoint an individual from health, building, safety, or DPW to oversee this legislation. We urge your support.
Thank you. Ralph Verney, Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee takes no position on this article.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 23? Yes, right here, please. Well, I first have to ask you, were you in favor of the 1-year or the 3-year term?
I'll never tell, Mr. Moderator. Robert Abrams, 24 Goodmans Hill Road. I have a number of questions about this because there's a reference to a state statute. We don't have a copy of that statute in the warrant. And it talks about trenches. And I'm wondering, does it apply to a trench if the trench is wholly on my own property? Does it apply to a trench if it's in a public way? Does it apply to a trench if it's in a private way? A number of questions that anybody involved in the process might help me out with. Who is going to be the person to enforce it? What are the fees going to be? We have very little information before us in the warrant except a reference to Chapter 82A, Section 2. Now, I've only practiced law in the Commonwealth for 35 years, and I'm sure there are many people in the hall more knowledgeable about the general laws than I. I'm not familiar with Chapter 82A, Section 2. So perhaps somebody could tell us what the statute says and what we're getting ourselves into if we do it. Thank you.
Thank you. Can you answer?
Mr. Moderator.
Town Council.
The statute provides that the town will provide for enforcement of the trenching regulations as adopted by the state. There's no choice but to do this and to pass a bylaw, and the reason for this bylaw is to allow the town manager to appoint the person. The regulations will provide for the penalties, and in answer to what trenches will be affected, it's my understanding, and this may not ultimately come to pass because they're going to be state regulations, but it's my understanding that those will be trenches on private ways, trenches on public ways, trenches on private property, and if there's any place else to put a trench, it will apply to those also.
Thank you. Do we have any other questions on our... yes, over there on the... Yes, right there.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Robert Coe, 14 Churchill Street. One thing that needs to be remembered is that just because you're going to dig a trench on private property doesn't mean that you can't have an impact well beyond that. There are a lot of places where phone lines and electrical wires and cable, TV cables and so on do cross private properties. And I know there have been in other towns that I know about, they've had problems. So somebody comes along and digs a trench, they don't get the proper permissions, and all of a sudden they do something that inconveniences a lot of people. So it's not so much an infringement on private property rights here as it is just a general common sense issue, I think.
Okay, anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, please stand.
Elizabeth McCarthy for Singletary Lane. What is your definition of a trench?
Mr. Moderator, I assume that question is directed at me. And unfortunately, I don't think I'm the appropriate person to answer that because a trench can be almost anything. It's important to note that the definition of a trench is going to be established by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And whenever that regulation is passed, that will determine what a trench is. I mean, obviously, I think you can take and put a shovel and drag a 2-inch trench along the dirt, and that would be a trench, but it's not one that I believe will be controlled or regulated by the state.
Yes. Mr. Drabinski, did you also want to answer this question? No, you need... That was not a rhetorical question.
I think Paul's answer is correct. I think anyone who's ever tried to erect a tent in their backyard for a social event knows you have to get a dig safe number. This is the exact same thing. Well, that's not a trench. It's, as Mr. Coe said, really tried to protect underground utilities. Under the OSHA classification, a trench would be anything greater than 4 feet in depth, and that would have trench protection. So it's basically really to protect the public and to protect the underground utilities.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 23? Yes, gentleman back there.
Mr. Moderator, Hank Surrett, Longfellow Road. I moved tonight.
I didn't hear that.
I moved. I was down front last night. In response to Mr. Coe's question, there are state statutes that govern the calls that one needs to make before doing an excavation under the so-called dig-safe statute or one-call statute. Before you dig in your yard or anywhere else, you're required to call the statewide number. It's now dial 811. The utilities then respond and mark their lines. That's independent of anything we do here. Second, independent of anything we do here, there are OSHA regulations that very specifically set out the kinds of worker protections that are necessary when one digs. My impression of this is it's too amorphous yet to be adopted by the town. We don't know yet whether or not the two-inch trench that one digs to plant peas will invoke applying for a permit from the town, nor do we know whether or not that permit's going to cost 50 cents, $50, or $500. So it would seem to me to make sense to defeat this article now, find out what the state regulations actually are going to be, find out what it is we're actually going to get, and come back at the next town meeting and look at it again.
Anyone else wish to be heard on Article 23? Yes, stand up, please, right in the middle. Can we pass the mic down?
Ms. Moderator, while you get to the phone, can I just point out to the hall that this regulation be promulgated in January of 2009? Our next town meeting will be in April of 2009, unless we have a special town meeting. So this legislation will be enacted, and the town will not have any protection to in way to enforce the legislation. So I urge the hall to support this, unless we want to spend $8,000 to $9,000 having a special town meeting so that we can enforce this statute.
Yes, sir.
My name is James Kelly. I'm the building inspector, and I live on 19 Oakwood Ave.
Jim, could you speak a little closer to the mic?
Jim Thank Kelly, you. Building inspector for the town of Sudbury. I was at a Department of Public Safety meeting last week. A trench is has to be greater than 3 feet deep and less than 15 feet wide. That is a trench. We have to pass this. We're actually ahead of most cities and towns, thanks to the proactive nature of this, and other city and towns who have had their town meeting recently and haven't done this are going to find themselves in a predicament where they have to enforce this. It's a state law. It's for the public safety. It's in response to a horrible situation a few years ago where a young girl got killed when she got buried by a collapsed trench. So this is necessary to pass tonight. Thank you.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 23? Town Council?
Mr. Moderator, I have the regulations and can answer some of the questions that were placed before.
Please.
I think the gentleman or someone just before me answered what a trench is. A trench is an excavation which is narrow in relation to its length, made below the surface ground in excess of 3 feet below grade, depth of which is in general greater than the width, but the width of the trench is measured at the bottom is no greater than 15 feet. With regard to where the trenches are, it says no person shall, and it says except in an emergency, make a trench excavation in any public way, public property, or privately owned land until a permit is obtained from the appropriately designated permitting authority. The issuance of a permit, and that was the purpose of this article, is each city, town, or regionalized entity shall designate one board or officer to issue permits for the excavation of trenches on privately owned land or land owned by the city or town. And that was the purpose of this article, to adopt a bylaw which would make the town manager the person who designated the permitting authority.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 23, or are we ready for a vote? Yes, there's someone back there. Stand up, please.
Robin Gunderson, 95 Fox Run. I'm just wondering if there are any projections on the amount of revenue this will generate for the town.
On the what?
The type of revenue this will generate for the town.
Yes, town manager.
At this point, it's pretty unclear to all of the town managers and town administrators and boards of selectmen across the state. This replicates in many ways what's happened in a number of times, whether it was through a carbon monoxide incident where a child passed away. The state puts in place a new statute and then afterwards develops the regulations and expects us to enforce it. It's an unfunded mandate. I don't know what those fees will be at this point in time. I mean, there's a whole lot is out there. The state stayed the introduction of it until January 1 because they know how much is not certain to us at this point. Most likely, I would appoint the town engineer, who's also the DPW director, who's also got 15 other titles. He's looking at me like, no. But was probably the person that, because we don't have anyone else who's going to have to be doing this sort of inspection and enforcement. I wish I could answer you. I don't know at this point. Just a lot unknown. But this is our point in time at which we can accept the bylaw so that we can make this appointment so that we can put this in place.
Okay. Question's been called. Is it seconded? It is. All those in favor of the call of questions signify by raising your cards. Those opposed? It's well more than two-thirds. All those in favor of Article 23 as it's written in the warrant signify by raising your cards. Those opposed? It passes well more than a majority. Article 24. John Donovan for a motion.
Move in the words of the article.
Is there a second? There is. Yes, sir, Mr. Donovan.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is John Donovan. I'm the Vice Chair of the Agricultural Commission in Sudbury. I would like to begin by reading a line from the Sudbury Reconnaissance Report for the Mass Heritage Landscape Inventory Program. To quote, preservation of agricultural landscapes means preservation of the farming activities, particularly in Sudbury, where farms are declining and their character is integral to the community's past. One of the recommendations from this report that we are trying to implement tonight is adopt the right to farm bylaw, which allows farmers to carry on farming activities. We have changed the title from right to farm to farming preservation since the primary goal is to maintain the current farming activities that are left in Sudbury and perhaps encourage those who still own farmland to consider putting it back into active farming. As in most Metro West communities, it became more profitable to sell the farmland for housing than it was to continue farming. As was the way in Sudbury when so many farms closed and sold the land to developers. Understand that the Farming Preservation Bylaw does not change any laws or regulations that currently exist that affect agriculture. It merely restates what is already allowed by state laws and regulations. When the town formed the Agricultural Commission, it showed the farmers that Sudbury recognizes this industry, even though the commission itself has no authority. It offers advice, mediation, and a forum for farmers' concerns. This bylaw effectively does the same. As you can see by the slides on the screen, these state laws already exist. Mass General Law 40A, Section 3, addresses zoning regulations. Chapter 90 allows farmers to operate unregistered motor vehicles, tractors, and trailers on public roads in town. Chapter 111 deals with the Board of Health and whether or not a farm becomes a nuisance outside of the normal operation of a farm. For example, spreading manure on a field does not constitute a nuisance, nor does noise from livestock or farm equipment. Passing this bylaw will show the agricultural community that the town of Sudbury supports the practice of agriculture, which helps to preserve and protect open space, which in turn makes the town a desirable place to live and raise a family. The most important reason to pass this bylaw is to notify residents and potential residents that Sudbury supports and values its agricultural businesses. Remember, keeping land and farming preserves open space, requires minimal town services, helps the environment, provides local food, and maintains Sudbury's rural character. To date, this bylaw has been accepted by every town in the Commonwealth where it has been proposed at town meeting. Some of these towns even implemented fines if potential buyers were not notified that they may be buying property in a town that supports agriculture. We have chosen not to do this as we feel it would be a form of ticketing of our real estate businesses. We prefer to have it posted as a public document, as a disclosure to potential buyers, or basically, buyer beware. If you buy next to a farm because you enjoy the scenery and the animals, don't try to put the farm out of business with complaints of the smell of manure, a tractor starting early in the morning, or roosters crowing. Remember, agriculture is not a 9-to-5 job. It is a way of life. Best of all, passing this bylaw will not cost the taxpayers 1 cent, but may save the taxpayers thousands of dollars in additional taxes if the farms were ever sold for house lots. Farming has been a mainstay of Sudbury's economy since its 17th century settlement. I urge you to support Article 24. And as an aside, I saw an excellent bumper sticker sometime in the past month. No farms, no food. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. John Drabinski, Ralph Verney for the Finance Committee.
Finance Committee takes no position on this article.
John Drabinski for the Selectman.
Yes, thank you, Ms. Moderator. In my opening comments last night, I talked about our sense of place. This article continues our sense of place in Sudbury. The Board of Selectmen unanimously support this article.
Just for the hall, the reason why the Finance Committee doesn't take a position is they only take position on money articles, and this is not a money article. Anybody wish to be heard on Article 24? Yes, right in the middle. Stand, please.
I'm Jeff Klopp, 15 Ironworks Road in Sudbury, and I'm the chairman of the Zoning Board of Appeals. In general, I'm in favor of agriculture. However, the Zoning Board has had a couple of cases in the last couple of years where there's been issues with farms operating and various things in some of the neighborhoods. So I guess I have two questions. One, does this in any way change the definition of farm that exists within the zoning bylaws that we have today?
To the best of my knowledge, no, it does not.
Okay. The second thing that I would say is that, while you don't want a ticket to enforce on that about declaring that there may be a farm in the area, I think it's necessary that be known in some ways. And if it requires a fine for not doing it, I wouldn't be opposed to that, because most of the cases we end up with are situations where, in one particular, I'm thinking of, the farm was clearly there, the homeowner should have known about it, perhaps wasn't told about it, but that ends up basically either with Mr. Kelly as the zoning enforcement officer or our board, and it generally is a no-win situation, and it's a very tense situation as well. So to the extent that people can be made aware of that so that they don't end up after the fact with problems, that would be helpful.
That's why we intend to post this at the town clerk's office, or have it posted at the town clerk's office. I would love to see a sign as you enter Sudbury. Sudbury supports agriculture. Sudbury is a farming community. Whatever it might take to let people know that we do support agriculture.
Thank you. Yes, please stand. Can we get a mic over there?
Barbara Gogan, 27 Concord Road. You only spoke of farms that had been there and then people move in. We live in a neighborhood where there is an area surrounded by homes, the fourth side by the Hot Brook. Most of those homes have children in them. Many of them have very young children in them. And we had a farm move into our neighborhood. And
I have no problems with the slope, you know, farm vehicles coming by, the people working there, the farming in general. To me, though, the pesticides, you know, right at the beginning, I thought this was a great guy. I only knew him because Debbie Dineen said he did all this recycling. I had a very positive attitude, called and said, look, I don't want to be a burden. Tell us when you're applying pesticides, you know, anything you tell us what pesticides you're going to apply, and I will be happy to disseminate it to the entire neighborhood. Okay, sure. Never heard from him. Never wanted to speak to us. All we want to know is, and he, you know, took down all of the buffer on his land between whatever he was doing and us, and applies pesticides right to the edge. Absolutely. And just there's no communication. I just feel there was no goodwill engendered. And I just am afraid that this might give any extra ability to endanger our kids. I just would hope that not. So just it's not farms that are just there. People move in and change the neighborhood at the same time. And I'm very sympathetic to farms that are there and people move in and then try to change them.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 24?
Can I speak to that for a second?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, to me. Thank you. This is exactly why the Agricultural Commission is in existence. You have a problem, come to us. We meet once a month at the Flynn Building, sometimes more than once a month. And also, the person who is applying pesticides, one, has to be licensed by the state, and two, has to follow state rules and regulations and use state registered pesticides in state-approved ways. I speak of that because I used to hold license number 3 in the state until I retired. So please come to the Agricultural Commission and we'll discuss it. We can mediate. We can find out what's going on, what your problem is, what the neighborhood's problems are. That's one of our functions.
Okay. Thank you. The gentleman...
Stephen Gabler, 28 Mossman Road. I generally support most of what is in this article. I very much appreciate the agriculture in the town, the food that I get from local farms. But I'm concerned with the language in the article is in some areas very loose. There, in terms of application of manure, fertilizer, and pesticides, there are responsible ways of doing that, and there are some not-so-responsible ways of doing that. And under the Right to Farm Declaration, generally accepted agricultural processes and practices, that embraces both responsible and not-so-responsible activities. And for the language of the article to embrace both, I think, is a flaw. I would like to see this reworked and represented with a little more restriction on some of those things.
Thank you. Anyone? Yes, right here, please. Stand up, please.
Laura Abrams, Agricultural Commission. As to regards to the pesticides in this, anybody that is a commercial farmer has to abide by the pesticide regulations set by the state. This does not change any of the state laws.
Thank you. Yes, way in the back, please.
Hi, Bob Capasso, 337 Hudson Road. I'm the fellow that has the stickers on the car with the No Farm, No Food. It's basically farm.org that represents that. One thing I just wanted to mention is I do appreciate the fact about the pesticides. I'm also an environmental engineer. But many farms are now going to organic farming practices, and the smaller local farms particularly are getting into that versus the large agricultural business practices. So you are going to see more organic farms, and if you support the local farmer and stress to him that you want them to use organic farming practices and you'll buy his produce for that reason, I think they'll support that. So again, I would support this article and look to see more farms in Sudbury.
Thank you. Someone on the end, all the way to the left on the aisle. Can you stand up, please, and get a mic?
Ralph Tyler, One Deacon Lane. I live next to a farm, and I'm supportive of there being a farm there, but I'm not supportive of this article because I've seen, and I've had some problems that we've had to deal with. One of the normal farming practices is to have cannons shot 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, to protect corn crops from raccoons. And if you're living near cannons firing at night, about 20-minute intervals, and this bylaw gives people that sort of permission, I think you're going to have a problem with the farmer. So I'm concerned that there's some open-ended language here. I've also seen pesticides applied with the, I guess it's some kind of an air gun or something that looks like a snowmaking equipment where you see this fog, and I've seen that in windy conditions where it's drifting into the neighborhood. And I've taken pictures of it and shown it to the farmer. I've experienced when it's been dry and cultivating with wind blowing and where I end up with about a quarter inch of basically dust on my patio and on my chairs and tables and everything. I don't think any of that is responsible, and I think that this bylaw or article, whatever you call it, is basically saying, hey, this is all wonderful. And then lastly, I'd like to say that manure sounds great. You know, manure sounds great, but there are ways, I guess, that you can age it so that you don't have fly problems. But when they don't age it properly, you do have fly problems, and you have fly problems for quite a while. So the idea that we're going to be promoting and just sort of, oh, bring the manure on and bring the flies into the neighborhood with all of the bringing the disease and whatnot onto your patio, dessert or whatever it is, I'm not in favor of that either. So I think this needs quite a bit of work. I think we want farms here, but I think the word should be talking about very responsible, and I'm not sure that we should be farming, frankly, exotic animals like camels and, you know, all manner of livestock like that. Personally, doesn't seem right in Sudbury to me, but that's just an aside.
Yes, in the first row here.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Michael Fee, Chairman of the Planning Board. Just want to let the hall know that the proponents of this article came before the Planning Board on several occasions to discuss the wording of the article, and it went through various iterations, all of which we thought was very positive. I think, notwithstanding some of the comments, a fair reading of this bylaw suggests that it is largely symbolic. It does not create any new rights or new remedies, and it is a declaration, as one of the speakers said, about how we feel as a town with respect to agriculture. It also has the positive impact of creating a mechanism for dispute resolution. So all of you who are standing and talking about the problems that you're having with your neighborhood farm, I think this is a vehicle to try and help solve those problems. Finally, the master plan talks about agriculture as being a laudable goal for this town as part of our duty to preserve our agricultural past. We think that this is a good way of recognizing that goal and furthering that goal. So the Planning Board voted unanimously to support this article.
Anybody else wish to be heard? Yes, right there, please. Please stand.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Helen Marie Casey, 85 Poconoket. From the Planning Board again, please. Could we get some clarification? I
I remember that we have commercial zoning and we have residential zoning, but I'm unclear about whether farming is mixed use, and so I don't quite understand whether there are boundaries in residential neighborhoods or not.
Boundaries in what sense, Ms. Casey?
Is farming legitimate in all neighborhoods?
Yes.
It is now?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, you can farm in any district. Yes, right here on the edge.
Move the question.
Is there a second? There is. All those in favor of the move of the question signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? Passes by well more than two-thirds. We're now going to vote. It's a majority vote. We're going to vote on Article 24. Take your time. All those in favor of Article 24 signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? Passes by well over a majority. We move on to Article 25. We have Chris Morley, chairman of the CPC, for a motion. Mr. Morley for a motion. Just go right ahead and make the motion. It'll get up there.
Okay, they asked me to wait.
Nope.
Moving with the words of the article in the amount of $2,300, $2,300 appropriated.
Does that receive a second? It does. Now, Mr. Morley, this is the first of several CPC articles. Are you going to give your usual overview of the CPC before you get into the specifics of this article?
Yes, I am.
And you may do so.
Thank you. Are we up there? No. It'll come because we're not going to get to 25 for a while. Good evening. As you can see from your warrant, the next 12 articles are recommendations from the Community Preservation Committee, or the CPC. I'm Chris Morley, the Planning Board representative of the CPC and the CPC chairman. As we do every year on our first article, I would like to take about 5 minutes or so to give you some overall information about where Sudbury stands with the CPA and then how we will proceed on our articles tonight. Then we will address Article 25 more directly. I have a lot to cover, but doing it now saves you from having me do it in bits and pieces. Article 25's presentation is a short one. And I would like to get to the first slide, so that's one reason why I shouldn't have started. Aha. There they are. That's my hardworking committee members. It is hard work. As you can see, most of us volunteer on two committees, some of us on more. But we really enjoy this work because of the enormous support and the impact that the CPA program can have on the way that all of us experience Sudbury and on the way that Sudbury will be experienced by generations to come. First, however, quick show of hands. How many people in the hall have read the CPA info sheet and financials that was handed out earlier and also last night? There's a whole bunch of them out there. Maybe your neighbor can, if you haven't seen it, your neighbor can hand you one. I believe there are some outside the hall as well. It's a very detailed sheet, and it's very helpful. The CPA is a state program funded by a local tax surcharge, a local tax surcharge, and by state matching funds. Sudbury became a CPA town in 2002 and collects a tax surcharge of 3%, the highest percentage option under the statute. More on that later. Details on how your surcharge is computed are in that handout I mentioned. The average CPA surcharge in Sudbury this year is $250. No change in what any of us pay is being contemplated here tonight or has ever been contemplated. Now, in wisely choosing that maximum 3% option back in 2002, town meeting got Sudbury a place in all three rounds in the state's formula for matching the revenues that we raise locally. In this way, for the first 5 years, we have received 100% matches. 50% of the money that we have spent on projects or saved for future projects has been supplied to us by the state. A recent drop in the state CPA fund's revenue has moved its trustees to prepare most participating towns for matching percentages in the low 60s. But Sudbury gets to participate in those two extra rounds. So even in a down revenue year, and even though the formula is biased against wealthier towns, so what's new? Our percentage match should move into the 70% range, and our matching funds for this past year could approach $1 million payable in October. We cannot forget that these matching funds are like manna from heaven, helping us to work towards the goals that so many hundreds of citizen volunteers have laid out for us in the town's master plan, the land use priorities plan, recreation master plan, community housing plan, and more. Recently, over 500 residents responded to a detailed survey about being used by the Open Space and Recreation Plan Update Committee for their report, which is currently in draft form. These grassroots efforts are what inform the work of the committees and the boards of this town, and so the work of the Community Preservation Committee. Our committee is, and has been from the beginning, governed by a very conservative plan of action. We are a prudent, careful bunch, and that is reflected in our spending policies, our bonding and debt service management policies, investment earnings policy, long-range budgeting efforts, even our membership in a CPA information clearinghouse and advocacy group, our eyes and ears and voice on Beacon Hill, keeping a close watch on that other pot of money. I like to use an old-fashioned phrase, we try to husband our resources so that the CPA in Sudbury will not flame out, but rather will achieve CPA goals in town for many years after this particular set of committee members has moved on. Second slide, please. We're already there. CPA revenue can be spent in the four different areas shown here. The state statute, are you on the second slide? No, you're on the third slide. The state statute requires the spending or reserving for later spending of a minimum of 10% of revenues in the first three categories. The remaining 70% can be appropriated in all four categories. Here in Sudbury, the CPC has been following a policy of roughly spending, over time, about 10% in the areas of community housing, recreation, and historic preservation. The goal of this policy has been to preserve revenue for future high-expense projects, which currently we anticipate mostly to be the purchase outright of open space or the purchase of open space-related development rights. Of course, this is real life, and projects don't come forward neatly arranged by our annual budget preferences. Our 10% goal, therefore, is not hard and fast. We don't reject projects solely on this basis. But in the absence of an especially compelling project, this rough budgeting has and will be a factor in whether the CPC forwards a project for town meeting approval. Now, the third slide. This slide shows the CPA amounts appropriated at the last five town meetings. Right off the bat, we see an example of the kind of especially compelling project that I just spoke of. CPA funds paid for just about half of the community field project here at LS 2 years ago. Prior to that expense, spending on recreation category was under 10% and has been heading back in that direction last year and this. Tonight, there are two worthy community housing projects on the slate, and they will push that category over 10%. But building housing is time-consuming, and they will not likely be back with such large projects for a while, and their percentage will begin to drop back down as well. That being said, there can be important projects that take us by surprise, no matter how well we plan. That is why we take such care in managing our funds and in maintaining the safety net of reserves that we have built up. And reserves leads me to point out that the figures you see here are not what we've actually spent on the projects to date. That's the next slide. In particular, our open space projects are bonded for 20 years. Why? First off, for practical reasons. Both the unpredictable timing and the high expense of open space projects makes waiting to accumulate enough cash a formula for developers to get there before we do. Secondly, for philosophical reasons, open space purchases are not just a great benefit, they're a forever benefit for the town. And the CPC feels strongly that no single group of taxpayers in 1 year should have to pay for accomplishing that. So consequently, we have actually been accumulating some cash, but not to spend all at once on one project, leaving no safety net in reserve for future projects, for unanticipated land deals or debt service or debt buy-down payments, bonding costs, and the like. This money is conservatively invested, but even so, interest earnings have added an additional $750,000 to our CPA revenue so far. Fifth slide, please. For years, I have said that there isn't enough money in the CPA to buy all the desirable open space in town. It's sad, but there probably isn't. The Open Space Committee has just combed the entire town, and they've come up with a list of 38 highly desirable properties, 21 of which appear here as priorities. However, if we manage our money conservatively, work closely and knowledgeably with landowners, plan as wisely as we are able, and have the timing gods on our side, we sincerely hope to be able to make a very good attempt at it. Just a final note on procedure. Tonight I'll be reading the motions for all 12 CPA articles, as I've already done for Article 25. I will then hand the presentation for the majority of the articles directly to the most appropriate speakers. I will be giving two short presentations myself and an overview of another article, but the more detailed CPC committee reports are in your warrant. If you haven't read them yet, I urge you to do so now as we go along. In them, you will find the most important points about each article. And now, on to Article 25. The town clerk, as the moderator informed us last night and may have tonight, but I didn't hear him, is unavoidably away, and the assistant town clerk is sitting up here behind me, doing what town clerks have been doing for 360-some-odd years at town meeting. So I'm going to present this article for them. Slide, please. Sudbury is well known among U.S. history academics. A popular colonial history text, Powell's 1963 Puritan Village, utilized Sudbury's well-collected 17th century documents to great effect. Not that we haven't saved anything since the 1600s. Many, many things have been tucked away in very safe places. But time marches on, and the 20th century in particular is becoming history as well. This project funds a professional evaluation of the permanent town records housed in the town clerk's office, the town hall vault and retention center, and these records are by their nature of historical importance to the town. As you see here in the slide, the survey will assess risks, policies, maintenance, environment and storage, and provide recommendations for a conservation and preservation plan for $2,300. The Historical Commission is in support of this project.
Thank you. I should have announced earlier, Mr. Morley was given more than 10 minutes for his presentation because he has 12 articles under CPC. So rather than having him speak a little bit before each article, we felt it more coherent. If he could say it all in the beginning. Thank you for your indulgence. We'll now ask the Finance Committee for their recommendation.
Finance Committee recommends approval of this article.
Mr. O'Brien for the Selectmen.
Board of Selectmen unanimously support.
Anybody wish to be heard under Article 25? The words are in the warrant, with the exception that the amount will be $2,300. I see no hands. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed. It is nearly unanimous. It passes. Article 26, Mr. Morley.
Move in the words of the article with the amount of $10,000 appropriated.
Does that receive a second? Yet, did you get the whole motion in there, Mr. Morley?
Yes, I did.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Morley.
Liz Radowski is presenting.
I'm sorry? The name of the person is?
Liz Radowski.
Of? What organization?
Sorry. Of the Historical Commission.
Thank you very much.
She's also at 3580 Lancaster Road. Yes, slide one. The military training field is located north of Route 20 near Wingate on Old Country Road, which then turns into River Road. It is on your right, and it is a distinct elevated ridge on the Sandy Hill Plain. The Sudbury Historic Commission, using its own funding, cleared the overgrowth on the 3-acre site and had contracted for topsoil stripping and screening with replacement of the soil to allow seeding of grass on the site. This was required because of all the roots and brushes that are in the field. The Sudbury Historical Commission planned the placement of 4-section split rail fence in front of the field to keep cars from driving on the training field. Our DPW had agreed to prepare a 3-car gravel parking area just off the road. Picnic tables and benches were planned to be placed there to encourage use of the site. The Historical Commission erected a kiosk which contains a map of the area, a copy of the article of the town crier of Sudbury Companies for the militia and the Minutemen gathered at the training field in May of 2005. It also has other required information. This picture is the rock that the Daughters of the American Revolution, the Wayside Inn chapter, erected and identifies the 1720 training field as Sandy Hill Plain,
with a storehouse for gunpowder and related supplies. The parcel was laid out in 1713 for the West Side Militia to drill, which they did prior to and during the American Revolutionary War. It is one of our oldest historic sites and is mentioned in the 1687 annual town meeting. Slide 3. This is a view of the field facing south. The Massachusetts Historical Commission has asked that an intensive archaeological survey be completed before these grounds are disturbed. Until that is completed, the Historic Commission efforts are on hold. The objective of the survey is to locate and identify any historical or archaeological resources. The survey will clarify the location of the documented historical military structures. Next slide. This is a view facing east. An intensive survey will need to be conducted under a state archaeological permit issued by the Massachusetts Historical Commission. Previous surveys in the Sudbury River Valley drainage area evidence prehistoric Native American archaeological sites, for example, fire pits, storage pits, and stone tool making. Next slide, please. This is a view towards the north, the Whalen Gravel Sand Pit. Field investigations will include a walkabout survey and conclude with about 50 centimeters by 50 centimeter test pits being dug and evaluated for findings. The project will require a technical proposal, an archaeological permit application, archival research on the area, field work, and the final product will be a technical report. The Historic Commission supports this motion, and I thank you for your consideration and hopeful approval of this motion.
Thank you. Bill Nealon, Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee recommends approval of this article.
Mr. O'Brien, Board of Selectmen.
Board of Selectmen supports.
Anybody wish to be heard on the $10,000 article? I see no hands. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. All those opposed. It is very close to unanimous. It passes. Article 27. Mr. Morley.
Move in the words of the article with the amount of $16,000 appropriated.
Does it receive a second? It does. Mr. Morley.
Yes, Lynn McLean of the Historical Commission will be presenting.
Lynn McLean, 209 Water Row, co-chairman of the Sudbury Historical Commission. The slide before you shows the Wayside Inn before the fire of 1955. This print was done by Ms. Hosmer, and we have made prints of it so it can be for sale. And if you come at Christmas time, you can purchase them. Next slide, please. This is Ms. Florence Hosmer herself. She's around 32 years old. This was painted by her standing in the storeroom in 1912 at the age of 32. This cost us $750 to have restored about 12 to 15 years ago. And then we had the cost of the framing. The cost of this work is going up, and we have many, many wonderful pictures to be restored. Next slide. This slide, little girl, is Barbara Trombley, who lived on Maple Avenue. When she was 85 years old, she came to visit me at the Hosmer House, and I took a picture of her under this picture here, which hangs in the upstairs bedroom, and she said she could remember Miss Hosmer putting that pink bow on, and she hated it. The next slide is of Barbara Maynard. She's wearing a yellow suit, which was Miss Hosmer's favorite color, and if you go through the house, you know her dishes are yellow and most everything's yellow. This was restored by contributions in the memory of Wynne Fitzgerald, who served on our commission for many years. This was paid for by many of her friends and relatives who donated something that she loved. We also have restored two more paintings, and that was with also money that people have donated in memory of Claire Jarvis and Mavis Fickett, who passed away and served on our commission for many years. Okay. This was entitled Closing the Veil. As you see, it needs some restoration. This was chosen by the Danforth Museum when they were going to do a show, and they came through the house and looked at many of her paintings. The show they put on were the three famous women artists of the time. One was Mabel Woodward, Mabel Polk, and Florence Hosmer. And they chose Florence Hosmer to be the poster and the bulletin for the show. Next. This is Ludwig Yeats from the Boston Symphony Orchestra with his bass. We have several sheets of music, and the BSO used to come to the Hosmer House for picnics on Sunday because Ms. Hosmer's brother, Bert, wrote music for the symphony. And she painted many, many of the musicians. And about 15 years ago, we had a show in the Lower Town Hall with all the BSO paintings that she had done. And she did those mostly in the 1920s. This here is labeled The Open Door. This shows a little girl in a red jacket walking with her mother towards the church. By looking out the front door of the Hosmer House, Miss Hosmer painted that. The little girl is Miss Hitchcock, who worked for many years in our local bank. She remembers stopping by for a cup of tea, and when she went to visit Miss Hosmer the next week, she had the painting. Next, please. That's it. Okay, Ada Falco and I have worked for 5 years cataloging each painting and numbering each one, comparing it with the Vos appraisal, which was done in 1979. There are 497 total, some oil, watercolor, charcoal, and sculptures. The town is in ownership of one valuable primitive of her fifth great-grandfather, which was painted in April 1801 and is kept in the town vault. We feel it most important to have an appraisal done of the most valuable paintings for insurance purposes. The cost of restoration and framing has increased in value of those we have restored. Miss Hosmer was born in 1880, and she died in 1979, and she willed the house, belongings, paintings to the town of Sudbury in 1979. We ask for your vote in favor of this article, please.
Thank you. Bill Nealon for the Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee recommends approval of this article.
Chairman Drabinski, Selectman.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. Board of Selectmen unanimously support this article.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 27, $16,000 for the paintings? I see no hands. All those in favor signify by raising your cards. Those opposed? It was nearly unanimous, but for a few negative votes. Mr. Morley, it passes.
Move in the words of the article with the amount of $14,600 appropriated.
Yes, does that receive a second? It does.
Debbie Dineen, the town's conservation coordinator, will present.
Thank you. Hello again. Debbie Dineen, 14 Firecut Lane. The article that I'm presenting right now is for the Stearns Mill Dam evaluation. The Stearns Mill Dam is a dam along Hop Brook. It's located on the northwest side of Dutton Road between Pratt's Mill Road and Moore Road. And yes, I'm absolutely positive it is all in Sudbury. The dam, the spillway, and 1 acre of land was gifted to the town in 2006. The Conservation Commission, the DPW Director, and the Park and Recreation Commission developed wonderful plans to create a small park along the frontage area on Dutton Road. The park would include a boat put-in area for small non-motorized boats, a fishing area, a small gravel parking area bounded by a split rail fence, and some interpretive historical signing about the history of the mill that was there and the dam. We plan to put a small seating area and take out all the overgrown Japanese knotweed that's around there and put some nice native plants in. You may have noticed that the trees have been cleared on the dam. That's part one of what we have to do to maintain this property. Dams and tree roots just don't blend well. In 2007, the town was informed that the dam must undergo what's called a phase one evaluation to determine if the current condition of the dam and to classify it under a hazard safety classification. This is something that's relatively new with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts through their Office of Dam Safety. Ever since we had some major flooding back 2, 3, 4 years ago, that office has become very, very active in making sure that dams throughout the Commonwealth are maintained. Therefore, we have to do the phase one evaluation on this property. If anybody is interested, I know we have a lot of attorneys here. The dam safety statute is Mass General Law, Chapter 253. If we don't comply, we are subject to fines. Stearns Mill Dam, which has also been known at certain times throughout history as Pratt's Mill Dam, was first constructed in 1790, although we found some variations in those records. It was reconstructed in 1915. Fire destroyed the actual structure, the building, in the 1960s. The final use of the mill was as a box mill. The dam itself is all that remains on this property. It's a stone structure that's approximately 15 feet high from the bottom of the spillway to the top of the spillway, and it impounds roughly 85 acre feet of water behind it. Again, that's Hop Brook. Should the evaluation show that the dam needs repairs, we'd first look into raising some funds, trying to get some grant money to fund any repairs that the dam might or might not need. We're fairly optimistic because, with the exception of Dutton Road, which has a huge culvert underneath it, the downstream area from this dam is all Water District property. But we do have to go through the exercise of the phase one evaluation, and once we do that and we know that the dam meets safety regulations or has some maintenance that needs to be done to meet those regulations, we can then proceed with our plans to enhance the historical, the recreational, and the ecological assets of this town structure. A vote in favor of this is a vote to preserve a very significant older piece of our history, and I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill Nealon, FinCom.
The Finance Committee recommends approval of this article.
Bill Keller, Selectman.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. The Selectmen unanimously support this article, and it's a public safety issue as well.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 28? Yes, right there, please.
Frank Lyons, 157 Wayside End Road. I just have a question about this. The Army Corps of Engineers is currently doing an evaluation, a study of dam removals in Sudbury. And as part of that study, I thought that they were doing some evaluation of all these dams. And I was wondering, Debbie, how does this relate to what the Corps of Engineers is doing?
It doesn't relate to it at all. They're two entirely different tracks. One is the Office of Dam Safety and one is the Corps of Engineers. The Corps of Engineers is not doing a study of the condition of the dam, nor is it doing a study to give it a hazard classification. That comes out of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts Office of Dam Safety. What the Army Corps of Engineers is looking at are different methods to look at potential ways to clean up Hop Brook from the excess nutrients. They're doing a sediment study and a potential dam removal study. However, at the latest meeting I went to, they have stated that they are not looking to remove the dams in Sudbury. Frank, I think you were at that meeting.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 28? I see none. All those in favor of Article 28 signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, requires a majority vote. It's nearly unanimous. It passes. Mr. Morley.
Move in the words of the article with the amount of $46,800 appropriated.
Does that receive a second? It does.
Jim Hill of the Historical Commission will make the presentation.
Hi, Jim Hill, 199 Concord Road, here in town, and Vice Chair of the Historical Commission. This is about restoring the windows in the second floor or above the first floor of the town hall. Mark? The official town hall is the official site, obviously, of the town of Sudbury. It was first voted for to build a town meeting in 1845. It was completed in 1848, burnt down in 1929, and was rebuilt in 1932. This is the restoration of the existing weight and pulley windows. Most people are probably familiar with those. Those are where the weights are inside the frame of the window and help the window go up and down. My understanding, these are the original to 1932. There's 19 12 over 12 light windows. Mark, if you go to the next slide, please. 4 8 over 12 light windows and 3 half-round fixed windows on the gable ends. One of those windows is actually just a sheet of plywood that's been painted to look like a window. We're hoping to put glass back up there. All those windows are above the first floor. Each one of the restoration of the windows itself, the consideration was to replace them or to restore them as original, and also taking into account the energy conservation and weather protection of the building itself. The total article is estimated at $46,800, all from historical, from CPA funds. These windows, as you can see, the condition of them from the outside. Basically, they would be disassembled and then all reglazed. All the framing would be rebuilt and all the weights and pulleys would be working properly. Next one. Again, some of the damage that's been done from the inside that needs to be restored. And then the last one, Mark. The building department came to us with this project. We agree with it, whether to replace them or to restore them. We have the support of the Historical Commission, the Building Department, the Selectmen, the Finance Committee, and the Community Preservation Committee. We urge the approval of this article. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill Nealon, Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee recommends approval of this article.
Bill Keller, Selectman.
The selectmen support this article. It has the added benefit of saving us some money on maintenance of the buildings.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 29? Yes, right here. Please stand. Can you pass the mic on that side to this gentleman?
Thomas Hollicker, Concord Road. Will these windows be double glazed? It wasn't clear to me how the energy.
Jim Hill, could you answer that question? Are they double glazed?
Yes. No, they won't be. They'll be as original, but there will be storm windows, historically hidden storm windows added to the window itself.
So thank you.
These would be storm windows on the inside.
That's the intention.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 29? Yes, all the way down the back to the right on the aisle. Stand up, please.
Dave Levington, Knob Scott Road. I wonder if somebody could tell us about the plans for Town Hall in general. The second floor, I don't believe, is really in active use now. Is this part of a plan for the future of Town Hall.
Mr. Hill, do you know?
I can't speak to the future of the building. I know the second floor is currently being used by the Sudbury Historical Society on a daily basis, as well as storing all their belongings there. Perhaps.
No, that's good enough. Thank you very much. Anybody else wish to be heard? This gentleman right here. Stand up, please.
Kerry Lynn, Maynard Farm Road. I just have a general question. When projects of this type come up, is there any is it normally handed out to people in Sudbury, or you know, who will perform the work? And just a curious, I'm curious to know whether we do the inspection, whether the town's responsible for inspection afterwards.
Mr. Hill, do you have an answer?
Yes. This project would go out to bid. There would be specifications that will be drawn up with Jim Kelly in the building department on how it's to what the final product is supposed to look like, and then it would meet that prior to payment.
And the building inspector would inspect that to make sure it was done properly.
Of course.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 29? So, yes, stand up, please, so we can see you. Great. Mike will be past you.
Mara Houston, Peckham Road. Is there any lead paint issues with these windows, and are there any extra expenses about lead removal?
Lead paint, Mr. Hill?
Not that we're aware of.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 29? I see none. All those in favor of Article 29 signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? Passes by well more than a majority. Article 30. Hang on, Mr. Morley.
Sure. Yes, you are.
My law firm was contacted a few months ago by the Sudbury Housing Trust and the Sudbury Housing Authority to assist them in some matters that turns out are now part of Articles 30 and 31. I wish to avoid even the appearance of a perceived partiality. I therefore have asked Assistant Moderator Fred Pryor to preside on the next two articles.
Article 30, Mr. Morley.
Move in the words of the article with the sum of $750,000 appropriated.
Is there a second? I see a second. Presentation.
Mike Fee of the Planning Board and the Housing Trust will present.
Good evening. Michael Fee, 48 Henry's Mill Lane. I'm chairman of the Sudbury Housing Trust, and that is the entity that would manage the funds appropriated under Article 30. I'd just like to give you a brief overview of the activities of the trust in the past and how we would propose to spend these funds if the article passes. First, as Chris mentioned, this is a community preservation allocation. This is not an override in any sense. It is not going to raise your taxes in any sense. These funds have already been allocated, and now of the three permissible uses, housing, open space, and historic preservation, we need to allocate them to each use, and housing is what the Sudbury Housing Trust focuses on. Also, by way of overview, I just wanted to address a question that was raised, and you may have been at the last special town meeting, that perhaps is a broader issue that we all need to think about when we're thinking about our vote on this article, and that is, why do we need affordable housing in Sudbury at all? And I suppose it's a fair question, but the answer to it is really very simple. It is required by law. Chapter 40B of the General Laws requires that every community must strive to attain at least 10% of its housing stock as affordable. And that is generally defined as attainable by folks making 80% of the area mean income. And that is what the trust strives to do. And it's our job to try and help the town attain that state-mandated goal. Now, whether or not you believe that goal is appropriate, I suppose reasonable people could differ on that. It's a policy debate that was played out at the last special town meeting. But for the purposes of considering this article, I would suggest to you that it's really not important. The state law is the state law, and how, whether or not we feel affordable housing is a good thing or a bad thing really doesn't matter. The law is the law, and as a town, we are obligated to implement and enforce it, and that's what the trust strives to do. You may recall that the trust hasn't been around all that long. It was first created by a 2006 annual town meeting vote. It was funded by a similar CPC article in 2007, and we're here tonight to try and continue the activities of that entity. So, what's the housing landscape in Sudbury? I'm sure you're all very familiar with the fact that we live in an affluent community. The statistics show that the average home price in town is about $683,000. And clearly that is a price point that is beyond the reach of folks in the municipal and service sectors who wish to own a home in Sudbury. Now, currently of our housing stock, there are 258 affordable units in town. And as a result of the programs administered by the town and the trust, currently seven of those are owned by the people that live in them. These home ownership units include four teachers, a local business owner, and an adult child of a Sudbury family, someone who grew up in town. And the average income of these individuals is $60,000 a year. Clearly, without the assistance provided by the town and the trust, home ownership to this group of people is something that quite possibly would not be attainable in Sudbury. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about the specific programs that we've undertaken over the past year. And you may have heard that the trust purchased a parcel of land located on the corner of Dutton and Pratt's Mill Roads and is working with Habitat for Humanity to develop an affordable home ownership unit on this site. The partnership with Habitat has generated a lot of interest in town, and so in addition to striving to meet our ultimate goal of providing another home ownership unit, it's also had the added benefit of bringing together a broad segment of the community to both fundraise and actually build the project. We're hopeful that ultimately this project will create a unit that is of high quality and that also fits in aesthetically and visually with the neighborhood around it. It's the type of project that we're very excited about, and we think it is a good model for the types of activities of scattered site housing that we'll try to pursue in the future. We also have an active home preservation program, and in essence what this does is the trust uses its funds to purchase deed restrictions on existing homes. And what that does, it restricts the resale value of these homes and thus converts them to affordable home ownership units in perpetuity. Those folks who are concerned with teardowns and mansionizations in Sudbury, it's not something that the zoning board or the planning board can really address under the current zoning law, but it's something that the trust can aggressively address and intervene when existing older homes of high quality become available. We can buy a restriction on these units and thereby convert them to affordable home ownership units in perpetuity. We think it has a dual purpose. And so last year we were able to purchase one affordable deed restriction in North Sudbury, and we hope to continue that type of work. We also do buy-downs on 40B units, and what that means is that developers are required to have at least 25% of their 40B units be designated affordable. We sometimes use funds, and we have done so on three occasions last year, to purchase additional units deed restrictions on additional units within those developments. And this is another way that we're able to create affordable home ownership options for residents. Finally, what we do is we also have a small grants program. And this is new, but what we do is utilize trust funds to provide financial grants of up to $3,000 a year for folks that are in need of repair and maintenance of their existing homes. And it's really geared towards seniors and folks who need a little bit of help maintaining their existing residences. Now, you've all heard the debate over what the role of the town is in providing some kind of assistance to seniors, and certainly this doesn't even come close to providing a property tax relief type of remedy for seniors, but It does, in a very real way, we think, provide assistance using town funds to eligible seniors that want to maintain and stay in their homes. The program is in its infancy, as I said, but we have sent out applications and made them available on the web, and we're hopeful that, again, this is the type of program that we can really take off with in the coming year. The last activity that we have is we've established a community housing office with a dedicated staff professional in the person of Beth Rust. She's able to monitor and enforce our deed restrictions that we purchase. She's able to also qualify the applicants for housing when we do have units come online. And she supports our efforts to outreach to the community and make our programs available to folks. So Article 30 requests $750,000, $250,000 of which is the 10% allocated to housing under the CPA rules. And we're actually seeking an additional $500,000 to try and continue and enhance the programs that I mentioned earlier. Programs like scattered site development with Habitat for Humanity, 40B buy-downs, and home preservation program. The reason that we're asking for this additional money, and it may come as a shock to you that it's such a big number, but in the past, our experience is that in order to create an affordable unit, it costs about $140,000 in subsidies. So each time we create a unit, that's what we're looking at as the budgeted amount. And so it's necessary for us to spend this kind of money if it is indeed a community goal to create this type of home ownership opportunity. You should have a balance sheet and a handout on the trust. We strive to make the finances and the financial activities of the trust transparent and to expend these funds in a careful, conservative way. The overall goal is to make sure that these home ownership units last in perpetuity. So one final thought that I want to leave you with, and it became clear to me during the last special town meeting that there are many, many people in town who support community housing and affordable housing and the town's efforts to increase that stock. But it also became clear to me that there are many people who don't think that that's the type of goal that the town should be pursuing. So I want to make it clear that if you are one of those people who thinks that the town should not be doing anything to balance this trend towards stratified, homogenous, mansionized neighborhoods, then don't vote for this article, because that's not what we're going to do with these funds. If, on the other hand, you feel, as I do, that this community has an obligation to devote our time and our resources to try and assist folks that live and work here to attain home ownership, and if you think it is the town's role to do something to address teardowns and mansionization, and if you think it is an appropriate use of town funds to assist people who need to patch their roof or make their house handicap accessible, then by all means, support this article, because that's what it will do. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fee. Mr. Jacobson, the Finance Committee.
Finance Committee recommends approval of the motion.
Mr. O'Brien, Mr. Fleckman.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. The Board of Selectmen unanimously supports and reminds the Hall that over the last, since 1999, it has been an annual event to have articles that address the need for affordable housing in different shapes and forms. As Mr. Fee said, the trust is a recent development, but going back to the master plan of 2001 and the statement of character of the town from 1999, affordable housing, diversity in the community, and maintaining the accessibility to the community by many different types of people have always been highlights of those reports, and we ask the Hall to support this so that sort of work can continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien. All those who wish to be heard, please raise their card. Yes, right here in front, fourth row. Ms. Crane.
Catherine Crane, 193 Goodman's Hill Road. I'm a member of the Sudbury Clergy Association, and we meet monthly. We met this past Monday. There are 10 communities of faith actively participating in this association. This not only includes ordained clergy, but also religious professionals. And they asked and encouraged me to speak on behalf of this issue, saying that in our opinion, it is not only a law that we are following, but it is a much higher goal to have a diverse and mixed community housing. We feel there's a wealth that can't be measured in having a more diverse community. And we also remind you that not all of our clergy or religious professionals can afford to live in Sudbury either, and that some of us would qualify for these kinds of housing. We are talking about us. We are talking about firefighters and teachers and town employees. And the Clergy Association urges your support of this motion.
Anybody else? Yes, in the middle. Can we get a microphone all the way in there, please?
Kathleen Bailey, 18 Summer Street. I just have a question on the houses that are owned, the houses that the Sudbury Housing Trust helps people buy. Are those housings still count towards the 10% that the town is required to have for the number of years that the residents are living in that home?
Mr. Fee or Ms. Rust, Mr. Fee?
The answer is yes.
So, and when they sell that house, is it still considered an affordable housing?
Remains affordable in perpetuity.
And as far as the deeds to avoid tearing down some of the older houses, are the abutters informed, or do they have a say in that particular situation?
I'm not sure that we're required to give abutter notice when we do purchase those deed restrictions. It is a private transaction, but we're certainly willing and able to have those conversations, and we routinely do reach out to the neighborhoods that we're active in.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir, and just next.
Peter Cohen from 7 Great Lake Drive. Is there a financial penalty or any penalty to the town if we don't hit 10%?
Mr. Fee, know the answer to that? Don't sit down, Mr. Fee. You can stand right up there.
The answer is no. There is no financial penalty if you fail to attain the 10% mandated by 40B. The law, however, in its practical enforcement, penalizes towns that do nothing to try and attain the 10% goal. And the way that that works is that when developers seek 40B permits and are denied by the town the right to build developments that are out of scale or out of proportion or grossly ignorant of the zoning restrictions in the neighborhood, when those denied permits are appealed to the Housing Appeals Committee, what happens is that that committee takes into consideration a town's track record with respect to its affordable housing performance. And so what we have done in order to make certain that we will have that benefit of the doubt should one of our 40B permits find itself before the Housing Appeals Committee is to adopt a housing plan, adopt a trust, fund a trust, and take activities that are designed to promote affordable housing, even though it is at a slow pace and will likely never get to the 10% threshold, making progress towards that goal is credited when it's reviewed by the state.
Okay. Anybody else? Yes, right in the middle, a little bit on the far side.
Tom Nguyen, 16 Curry Wayne.
Can you speak up a little bit, please?
Yes, Tom Nguyen, 16 Curry Wayne. I had a question for the Housing Trust, just a clarification point. For purchased units that you were talking about earlier for subsidy, what's the cost of those units, roughly, your share of the cost? For
purchasing units?
I thought you said about $140,000.
It's about $140,000 on average.
And that's a home ownership program?
It's a subsidy.
It's a subsidy, so it's a rental unit?
There's various different types of units that we can purchase deed restrictions on, or that's basically
well,
it.
I guess what I was looking for clarification on is once the money is allocated and the unit is purchased, do the residents get to purchase it, or are they renting it from the housing trust or the housing authority?
No, we don't rent.
So they own it?
Correct.
Okay.
It's all about home ownership.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Right next to him, yeah.
Dennis Forshade, 307 Maynard Road. I just have a question. I'm all for affordable housing. I'm curious, with the control that we have over it and the housing going in, what percentage would you see it increasing the enrollment in the school system, and over what period of time?
You know, Beth Rust has a better handle on these numbers than I do.
Ms. Rust?
I'm right here. So we've done a lot of work into the number of school-age children and the fiscal impact that affordable housing has on the town. And there have been some regional studies on that, and I won't go into that detail in the interest of time, instead to talk a little bit about our Sudbury experience. In Sudbury, there are fewer pupils in affordable home ownership units than in single-family market-rate homes. This has been reported also by the school superintendent. Not surprisingly, the Sudbury school system finds that larger detached homes house more children than smaller homes and condos, right? So if you have a two-bedroom condo, our average is 0.5 children per condo versus large detached, you know, single-family market homes of 1.8 children for average.
Thank you, Ms. Rust. Anybody else? Yes, sir, right there. Can you get him a microphone, please? Gentleman in blue.
Hi, I'm Terry Keeney, 71 Blueberry Hill Lane. Question is, where are we in Sudbury relative to the 10% in terms of meeting that goal?
We're at 4.8% now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, way over there.
My name is Tom Arnold, 20 Kendall Road. Question was asked a few minutes ago about whether there's a penalty if we don't meet the 10%, and I'd just like to elaborate on that a little bit. In Concord a few years ago, there was a developer who came in on a 25-acre parcel with about 400 condo units. Now, the problem under 40B is that if you don't meet the 10% requirement or you're not showing progress towards meeting the 10%, the local zoning board, our own zoning board, cannot stop a developer from having a development that does not comply with density requirements under the zoning bylaw. Our zoning bylaw generally is a 2-acre lot requirement. If you have a parcel that's 10 or 15 acres in your neighborhood and you have a developer who comes in and wants to do a 40B project, he's not limited to, you know, splitting that up into 2-acre lots and a standard subdivision. He can come in and put in a much bigger project. And think about the effect on the schools of having that density. We have a problem, it was said last night, that the problem for our schools is that we have more children in per capita in Sudbury than most other towns, and that's why our school budget is so high compared to other towns. Well, imagine what the impact would be if these undeveloped parcels are developed under 40B with maximum density by the developer. That is a financial penalty. I support this. I think it's a good idea for the reasons that Michael has suggested, that we need to have a mix of housing in town, but it also doesn't cost us anything. I mean, this is a win-win situation.
Thank you. Way up and back there. Mr. Surratt.
Moderator Hank Surratt. I must admit to being somewhat confused by this article. It seems to me that we're giving the trust $750,000, but they're not telling us where or what they're going to buy with it. And my sense is that, I mean, I'd like to know what we're buying.
Mr. Fee, can you answer that one? Or Ms. Rust?
It's a secret, Frank. Seriously, we don't know what we're going to buy. Because the real estate market is so fast-paced, we have to, the reason that the Sudbury Housing Trust was formed in the beginning was to be able to react quickly to opportunities that present themselves. And so, you know, folks die and their houses are on the market, and quickly they are snatched up by developers who tear them down and build a mansion. The Sudbury Housing Trust has to be able to address those issues quickly and flexibly. And that's why the presentation focused on the types of programs that we use and the things that we have done in the past. Are we going to focus in on one or more of those types of programs in the future? I can't tell you, but I know that that's what we've done in the past, and that's the route we're going in the future.
Before I get a second on that, is who else wants to be heard on this subject, and is there anything new that they can only say something that's new? I see one person. Two people. Why don't we have both those people speak in the far corner there.
Greg Yammons, 1 Snowberry Lane. I'm a teacher here at Sudbury, Lincoln Sudbury High School, and a recipient of an affordable home in Sudbury, so I'm obviously a supporter of this article. And I wanted to put a face to it here tonight and urge you to vote yes on this article. It's a quality of life issue for many of the people that work in this town. If you're talking about putting roots in the community and people that want to be in this community and give back to the community, this is a great opportunity to do that. And again, I urge you to vote yes on this article. Thank you. And thank you, Town of Sudbury, for affording me this opportunity.
This gentleman in the middle, please. Last person to speak.
I'm Jeff Klopp, 15 Iron Works Road, and I'm chairman of the Zoning Board of Appeals. I just wanted to also address and echo the point that Mr. Fee made about not necessarily knowing where the money's going to go. The Zoning Board has appreciated the partnership that it's had with the Housing Trust in being able to be flexible in working with developers that have brought 40B projects before the town. In terms of the 40B law is a bit of a straitjacket, but the Zoning Board tries to work with the neighbors and with developers to work in a situation that wins for everybody, that there's affordable housing, that the character of the neighborhood is preserved, and that opportunity is provided to other people. And in many cases, the money that's available through this trust gives us some flexibility in terms of when we work in those negotiations. So I urge support of this article. Thank you.
Thank you. Do I have a second on calling the question? I do. Are we ready to vote? This is a... Pardon me? Yes. I'm going to not take that. I'm ready to vote on this. All those people in favor, this is a majority vote, all those people in favor of this article, please raise your cards. All those people in favor of calling the question, please raise your cards. All those opposed, it carries. Back to the main motion. Article 30. All those people in favor of Article 30, is a majority vote, please raise your cards. All those opposed. It passes pretty much unanimously. Article 31, Mr. Morley.
Move in the words of the article with a sum of $600,000 appropriated.
Is there a second? Second over here.
KP Kang of the Sudbury Housing Authority will make the presentation.
Thank you. KP Kang, 96 Old Garrison Road. I'm also the current chair of the Sudbury Housing Authority. Okay, I'm going to first do just a general background of the Sudbury Housing Authority and what we do and what kind of housing we provide. We are a local self-sufficient entity, and our primary mission, our mission, is to manage and develop affordable rental housing for families, seniors, and the disabled. So we're kind of the other side of affordable housing from the Housing Trust. They do a home ownership, and we do a home rental. Now, we're local in the sense that we are governed by a board of commissioners, and the board of commissioners, there's five of us. Four of us are elected community members, and one is a state-appointed community member. And then we're lucky enough to have two associate members recently because there's been a lot of interest in the Sudbury Housing Authority. We are also local in that we do have a preference for local tenants. So if you have some affiliation with Sudbury, whether you work here or you have family here, you do have a preference in terms of qualifying for our housing. We are also part of the community housing plan that was developed by the Community Housing Committee. We are self-sufficient in that we're not part of the town budget. We don't take any money from the budget. We are self-supporting through rents. And then we also receive no operating subsidies from the state. So some housing authorities do, but ours is managed so well, we have a great executive director, that we don't take any subsidies for operation at all. We are nonprofit. It's not going fast enough, okay. And then we're governed by the state regulations, though. So let me talk about the need for family housing. I think we need to do this, okay. We currently have 64 one-bedroom apartments for seniors and disabled at Musketaquid Village, but we only have 21 family units on scattered sites throughout the town. We currently have no vacancies on our waiting list. And we have a very, very long waiting list, as I will elaborate as we go along. We've also discovered that there's been a change in family sizes. We have some units that are rather large, and most of the people on our waiting list are looking for 2- and 3-bedroom apartments. So who are our tenant families? Well, they're members of our community. 13 out of the 20 families have members who have lived, grown up, or worked in Sudbury. So as I said before, most of them have ties to Sudbury. And those who are working, these are working people. Those who can work are working. And these are some of the common professions or jobs that they have. We have school bus drivers. We have social workers. We have a tutor at LS. We have bookkeepers. So these are ordinary working people. We also house families that are facing challenging circumstances. We have 4 families with disabled parents. We have 11 single-parent families. And you know how difficult that is. So these are people in need. As I said, we are now looking at smaller families by and large. We are seeing that our waiting lists are people are looking for 2- and 3-bedroom units, and this will answer some of the somebody's questions going to come up on how many children are we adding to the school system. two- and three-bedroom units. Two-bedroom units are two-bedroom units, average one child per family. The three-bedroom units average approximately three children per family, whereas four- and five-bedroom units average five children per family. So we want to start switching from four- and five-bedroom units to two- and three-bedroom units. Because we also have the waiting list. As I said, there are 39 families waiting for two-bedroom units, and there are 32 families waiting for three-bedroom units, and there's only nine families waiting for four-bedroom units. So you can see that our need is really for two- and three-bedroom units. Now, I also am showing this slide to our scattered site housing. Really, we try to blend them into the neighborhood. So if you look at these houses, some of these are Sudbury Housing Authority houses, and some of them are not. So we try to make an effort, and I think it's a good idea. Scattered site housing helps blend the houses into the neighborhood. We don't want to stand out, and I think our properties are well maintained, and the tenants then belong to the community. So which ones are Housing Authority houses? Those are the ones that are Housing Authority houses. So in the past, we have made some efforts. It's a slow process to gain additional units. So in the past, we have made some efforts. In 1990, we built some new duplexes. Some of you may be familiar with them. There's three of them over on Fairbank Circle. Then in 2003, members served on a Blue Ribbon Site Selection Committee to look for potential sites to build new housing. That, unfortunately, was not successful. And then in 2006, we received some CPA funds for a condo purchase program where we would buy some affordable units in the privately developed 40B developments. And we are ready to purchase as soon as they're built. Now, our current effort that we are bringing forth with this article is our 2008 redevelopment. And what the plan is, it involves four existing properties in North Sudbury, four existing properties that we own, that we currently own, the Sudbury Housing Authority, and one existing property in South Sudbury that the Housing Authority currently owns. Okay, more specifics about the project. In terms of history, the North Sudbury houses were built in the 1950s. Ranch houses, U.S. Steel homes, and they were purchased by the Housing Authority in the 1970s when the state allowed housing authorities to purchase homes. They no longer do that. And the South Sudbury lot house was donated to the Housing Authority.
Did you restart it?
The objectives of this redevelopment project are many. We want to the opportunity. I guess this went too fast. I'll go back. Okay. Is to upgrade older structures. As I said, the 1950s houses are very old and are difficult to maintain, and they need a lot of upgrades. So this is an opportunity to do that. As I said before, we would like to meet the needs of our smaller families on our waiting lists. We don't need these houses are in North Sudbury are four and five bedrooms, and we don't really have a need for those, whereas we do need two and three bedroom homes. And when these homes are new or upgraded, they're difficult to upgrade, so we want to build new. It would be easier to maintain them. They would be more energy efficient and, all around a plus for the Housing Authority.
Excuse me, Ms. Kang, your 10 minutes is nearly up. How much longer are you going to be?
How much longer? I guess a little bit longer.
Another 2 minutes. Will that do it?
Okay, I'll go faster.
Thank you.
All right, scope. All right, I have to tell you what the scope of the project is, which is to demolish 4 existing single homes and build 5 new duplexes in their place. That's in North Sudbury. There will be no net increase in the number of bedrooms on these sites. So if it was a 5-bedroom, it'll be 2 and 3. If it's a 4-bedroom, 2 and 2. I like that. The average number of children will have, in fact, reduced number of children, and then we'll have a net gain of 6 units. The funding we're seeking is $600,000 in CPA funds, which is $60,000 per unit, $715,000 in state grants, and then $1.5 million will be taking a mortgage, which will be repaid through rents. Now, these are what sort of befores and afters of what the architect has done. I don't think we have to dwell on these, so I'm going to just skip over these quickly. The South Sudbury site is between Eddy Street and the town line. So all these projects are going to be architect designed. They're modestly scaled homes. They're two stories replacing ranches, which I think we think will fit better into the neighborhood. They're smaller footprint, and they are going to be New England farmhouse style architecture. I'm wondering if we need to, we did have an abutters meeting, and there are some concerns that the abutters had, which abutters meeting March 10th, and we are addressing them. The impact of duplexes, there's no evidence that duplexes impact property values. There are 26 other market value duplexes in town, and of course the new Habitat for Humanity duplex that is being proposed and widely supported by the town. So there is precedence for duplexes. There was objection to one particular unit building having too many bedrooms. We are changing that, reducing the bedrooms. And then detailed design decisions. It is a little bit too early to get into details, but we are committed to including the abutters in the process. So this is my final slide. All right. So the project process is a long process from here. We have many, many steps. January, we hired a design team. We had our first abutters meeting in March. Site surveys and soil testing is in progress. And we are here at town meeting to seek approval of Article 31. We will continue with detailed design and additional abutters meetings. We will need approvals by the Mass Department of Housing and Community Development. We will need approvals by the Sudbury Board of Health. We will need approvals by a comprehensive permit from the Sudbury Zoning Board of Appeals. We will have to submit grant applications to various state funding programs. We will have to engage in a public bidding and construction process, and we're targeting completion of these units in the fall of 2009. So we need your support.
Thank you, Ms. Kang.
Okay. Did I make it?
Yep.
Thanks.
Mr. Jacobson for the Finance Committee.
Finance Committee recommends approval of the motion.
Mr. O'Brien for the Selectmen.
The Board of Selectmen supports this and feels that it's in harmony and complements the previous article that was unanimously passed.
Those that would like to be heard, please raise your cards. We'll take one way over there.
Allison Thatcher, 12 Chanticleer Road.
Can you speak up, please?
Sorry. Allison Thatcher, 12 Chanticleer Road. I have a question concerning the families who are currently there. There are families who live in these houses. Where are they going to go? Where would they be living during the construction process? What schools would their children be going to? Are they going to be bused from wherever they're going to be to the school that they're currently enrolled in? How is this going to impact those people? Secondly, it's well known in the neighborhood that there is one family who really is very difficult. There have been many calls to the police. There's been criminal activity there. What are you going to do to try to prevent us from having twice as many families who are so undesirable moving into the community? What is your screening process going to be? Will it be better?
Ms. Kang or, yes, Ms. Klein?
I'm Sherry Klein, 84 Concord Road. I'm on the Sudbury Housing Authority Board as well as the Community Preservation Committee. One of the goals, as Typhi indicated, is to get smaller units, which will in turn have smaller families and fewer children. I think that's one of the things that you addressed. The other is there a plan to deal with the families that are currently housed? Yes, there is. Our executive director has been planning for this for some months, and she has a detailed plan as to how to relocate the existing families within our properties to keep them housed. In terms of...
The question was not just to keep them housed, but are you going to take these children out of their current school for a year because their house is in a different district and then bring them back?
That I can't respond to. I don't know where...
I think those families deserve that, to know that prior to being relocated.
Okay, I'm advised they're going to be permanently housed in the new locations. But again, the other part of this is that it's an ongoing process. But to address your concern about families, I'd like to talk a little bit about the process for selecting the new tenants. First, of course, they have to meet the financial eligibility requirements. And in connection with that, the people who have applied on our list, the person who is next in line for our two-bedroom house apartment has been on that list for 4 years now. So when the units become vacant, we do a detailed research of their financial background. They're required to provide us with financial information that has been independently checked. We, of course, have requirements as to how many people can go in the units, and so that has to be verified that there are not too many or too few people for each unit. Secondly, the executive director does a detailed search of the landlords of each tenant for the past 5 years. They can be disqualified if they have a criminal activity on their record, if they have a history of disturbing their neighbors, if they've caused property damage to prior apartments, if they have unsanitary housekeeping habits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And finally, a Corey check is done on all the applicants. So once a family moves in there, there are a number of requirements in the leases to what they can and cannot do. And chief among them, of course, is criminal activity. However, the Sudbury Housing Authority, like any private tenant, has to take their case to the court. And in this particular situation that the woman is addressing, steps have been made to that effect. It is finally up to the court whether the eviction will be granted. But the Housing Authority makes every effort to make sure that our tenants are good tenants. And I think of note is that we have 21 single-family rental units, and there's only one house that's a problem. And again, it's one of the larger family units.
Thank you, Ms. Klein. It's the gentleman in the middle here, please.
Morgan Lloyd, 12 Ellsworth Road. In the interest of time, I'll be very brief. I think one of the things that I heard tonight is that there are very little details. You heard that from the speaker, that there are more details to follow. I think I thoroughly support, as an abutter to one of these properties, diversity in terms of housing in Sudbury. With that being said, that should not replace diligence in terms of having a full plan in place, be that how these houses will look, where these families will go. We have a unique opportunity here to involve the neighborhood outside of a single abutters meeting, and I think we should all think about that moving forward.
Anybody else wish to be heard? I see nobody. Oh, excuse me, down front here.
Good evening. I'm Amy Lepak.
Can you speak up, please?
Is it on? Yes. All right. My name is Amy Lepak, 54 Jarman Road. I'm a member of the Sudbury League of Women Voters, which voted unanimously to support this article. We've long supported initiatives of the Sudbury Housing Authority, including the land transfers allowing the previous duplexes built in 1990. This new proposal makes efficient use of land already controlled by the SHA and allows more needy families to be served without increasing total bedrooms on redeveloped lots. During the Massachusetts League's housing study this fall and winter, we learned that Massachusetts produces multifamily housing at only a third the national rate, and that 46% of Massachusetts renters pay more than 30% of their income for rent. These statistics show the crying need in Massachusetts for more affordable rental housing, and this proposal will create 6 new units of it, plus 4 replacement units, all sized to better fit the families on the SHA's waiting list. We urge you to support this worthwhile endeavor.
Are we ready to vote on this? This is a majority vote.
Oh, excuse me. Tommy,
I didn't call on you. I'm sorry. Is there a second to calling the question? All those in favor of calling the question? All those opposed? Okay, the question has been called. Are we ready for a vote? All those in favor of Article 31, please raise their cards. All those opposed? It passes pretty much unanimously.
Article 32, Mr. Morley, for motion.
This is a long one I get to read. Article 32, Community Preservation Fund CSX land purchase. Move to approve the recommendation of the Community Preservation Committee to appropriate the sum of $420,000 from Community Preservation Act funds for the purpose of purchasing in fee simple approximately 9.76 plus or minus acres of undeveloped land known as the CSX Rail Corridor and running south from a point near Union Avenue and Station Road to the Framingham Town Line, subject to receipt of funding from other sources in an amount no less than $247,350, and further subject to the condition that the town not incur or accept any liability of or from the grantor or its predecessors, and for all expenses connected therewith, including bond and note issuance expense, and to raise this appropriation. The Treasurer, with the approval of the Board of Selectmen, is authorized to borrow $420,000 under MGL Chapter 44B, Section 11, and MGL Chapter 44S.7, Section 3, or any other enabling authority. That the Board of Selectmen is authorized to take any other action necessary to carry out this project, and that $37,800 be appropriated for the Community Preservation Act funds to pay debt service to on any such bonds or notes.
Does that receive a second? It does.
I've got one more to go. Sorry, if you want me to finish.
Go ahead. No, please. Sorry.
All appropriations shall be allocated equally to the categories of open space and recreation, and the appropriation for debt service funded first from open space restricted reserves and second from general unrestricted reserves as necessary to be used in conjunction with funds for transportation or other purposes.
Does that receive a second? It does. Ms. Deneen for a presentation.
Actually, I'm going to just speak briefly.
Excuse me?
I'm going to just speak briefly, and then Ms. Deneen is going to.
Knock yourself out.
All right, I'm just going to quickly cover two items. First, if you look in your warrant at the Selectman's report on this article, which was written later than the CPC's committee report, you see their intent to fund $30,500 of this purchase out of developer-supplied Route 20 traffic mitigation funds. This funding would give a future town meeting the ability to authorize construction of an extension of Knobscot Road along a part of the railroad right-of-way so that it would connect to Union Avenue. The concept of this connection has been contemplated for many decades and appears as a recommendation in the town's first ever master plan in 1962. All north-south traffic in Sudbury has to get onto Route 20 first in order to continue on their way. Traffic studies dating back to 1984 have demonstrated that a large amount of traffic in front of Sudbury Farms, the most congested portion of Route 20 in town, is trying only to do just that. There is room in the railroad right-of-way for both a road and a walkway. However, this is not something that's happening anytime soon and may never happen. This would be a many-year project even if we started working on it tomorrow morning. The purchase of the property and this funding arrangement just makes it possible. All of the planning and expenses for such an undertaking would, of course, be dependent upon future town meeting approval. Second, I just want to address the rail trail issue. Many in town support a rail trail. Many in town oppose a rail trail. Many more, I suspect, have deep concerns about the way in which and of what material a trail would be constructed. This article deserves the support from all three groups, and even the fourth group that doesn't care. The rail corridor north of Union Avenue is owned by a state transportation agency, as is the east-west rail corridor in town. In the end, perhaps even many years from now, those entities really hold the upper hand in whatever takes place on their land. Here we have the opportunity for very short money to control our own destiny in this regard. Ownership is power. And now David Deaney will tell you many more reasons why this article is a great opportunity that we shouldn't pass up.
Good evening again. I'm still Debbie Deneen, and I still live at 14 Firecut Lane. And I'm going to try to be brief tonight. Okay, where is the rail trail that we're talking about? This is the CSX right-of-way corridor that begins at the Chiswick Park Access Road off of Union Avenue. That's where the old Crumble Station, where you've been here a long time, or if you haven't been, it's where the AAA limo is now. And it runs south to the Framingham Line. It's mostly a 66-foot wide corridor. In some places it goes down to 50 feet, but it does contain 9.6 acres. And that's not a coyote, that's my dog in the picture. If you see the double green lines going down through blue blotches, I can interpret that for you. The double green lines are the right-of-way, the CSX right-of-way. They start, as I said, by Crumble Station. They cross Route 20. They go past Friendly's, and then they go into an area that's mostly wetland area. It's a very beautiful area that approaches Water District and town property. Okay, the price that we've negotiated with CSX is $700,000. We have received a drinking water grant for $247,000, $350 from the state. The Sudbury Water District is contributing $25,000. As Mr. Morley just explained to you, there's also a possibility of a roadway extension for a roadway roadway realignment that where the town would contribute another $30,500. That leaves the total basic CPC cost of $397,150. You add to that the bonding cost and you get to the $420,000. The drinking water grant expires on June 30th of 2008. That has become problematic for us at this point. In order to get the best bonding rates and optimistically bond at the same time with the Knobscot purchase, what we've decided to do, we cannot roll the grant forward to the next grant cycle. There is another grant cycle. Our planning director has had conversations with the state, and we are looking to not roll the grant forward, but resubmit the grant package, and we're very optimistic that we're going to get those same dollars back. Again, if we do in the long run, it does save the town money with the bonding costs. We're looking at every way possible to keep the costs of this down. We do, however, have to negotiate the final purchase and sale with CSX by May 8th of this year. Our negotiating ability is governed by the Federal Surface Transportation Board and the abandonment proceedings that CSX Railroad has gone through. We're hoping, we've come a long way with CSX. We still have some outstanding issues to address with them. And we're hoping that a vote of town meeting tonight will give us a little bit more leverage with them to move this forward. If we don't meet this deadline, and if we're not successful, CSX will then be able to market this property on the open market. I do want to remind you that using CPA funds, that a minimum of 50% of the cost of this purchase is something that is paid for by the states contributing to the CPA account. This is just, I have a couple quick slides of this if you've never been on it. It's really quite a beautiful area. The rails and the ties have been removed. They were removed because CSX had a fairly serious it's after 10 o'clock. It's my bedtime. Thank you. A derailment. I'm not a night person. Had a very serious derailment, and as a result of that, they either lost a lot of the track or they had to remove a lot of the track to get the cars that went off the track itself out of the welland. I can ask about environmental issues. It's a railroad. Well, the first thing we want to do is eliminate the risk of any drinking water degradation from risky uses. I will get to this momentarily. We want to eliminate the railroad use because of their continual use of herbicides along the right-of-way. We're looking for a low-cost solution to protect our water supply. This is short money for huge protection. We want to secure permanent access to the east side of the Mahoney Farm. The town owns a good portion of the Mahoney Farm, well over 30 acres, and it's not bisected, but about a quarter of the parcel is on the east side of the track. There is no easement to us to get there. Okay. We also will not go ahead with this purchase if the town has to take liability for any past contamination. As a result, we have to do some soil testing. We're very confident the groundwater in that area has been tested continuously at a very high rate because of our wells. I do want to stress that this is our one-time deal to purchase this. May 8th, any leverage we have, any clout we have through the abandonment proceedings goes away. Going on to the next. This is why it's so important for the water supply. Five of Sudbury's wells are located between 20 feet, yeah, that's not a misprint, that's 20 feet of the actual track bed and 3,000 feet of the actual track bed. Well number 7, which is one of our main working drinking water wells, is 20 feet from the rail bed. From there, wells 9, 2, 6, and 4 vary between 1,000 feet and 3,000 feet. This is a little bit fuzzy graph. Hopefully it's fuzzy and it's not me in the hour. And that shows you where Zone 2 is. There are also three Zone 1s within that area. Zone 1 is a radius around the well where pretty much nothing except trails can go. Zone 2 is the area of direct groundwater contribution to the well. And you can see that this rail line runs right through that area. Okay. What will we do with the right-of-way? We don't know. That will be up to a future town meeting. Some things that have been discussed are a public potential future trail improvements. Any future improvements for a trail will have to be compatible with water supply protection. That is an absolute. If the town does purchase this, it will be a trail as is immediately after closing. We discussed the realignment near Knobscot Road by Route 20, and we will enter into a formal agreement with the Sudbury Water District to allow them to maintain their wells and to have vehicular access to them for maintenance. A couple of quick pictures. You can see in the left-hand picture, a good portion of the trail is level and has a nice stone dust surface that's stabilized by vegetation. The upper right-hand picture, again, dog, not coyote, that's looking west towards Mahoney Farm. That's the town-owned Mahoney Farm area. The bottom view is looking northeast across the marsh. Here you can see a section of the trail that has some ballast rock on it. That was rock that had to be put down when they had to take the box cars out of the wetland. What a lot of people don't know about is there is an area of land that is managed by the Conservation Commission. It's owned by the general government of the town of Sudbury, Board of Selectmen. It's mostly wet, but there is a wonderful, about 7 or 8 acre upland section that the only way you can get to it is from this railroad bed. Purchase of this will allow us to extend a trail down, not only into the town on Mahoney Farm, but also into this small area of conservation managed area. You can see there just a couple of quick pictures of that.
Ms. Deneen, how much longer we have?
15 seconds. Okay. Just want to repeat again. This is a one-of-a-kind property. You cannot put together a linear corridor. If CSX sells this, they are under no obligation to sell it as a linear corridor. This purchase of this property will not raise your taxes. It is CPA funds, as Mr. Morley explained. And most importantly, ownership of this land will put control of what happens to it in the future in your hands. The Conservation Commission urges your support. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Jim Jacobson, FinCom.
Finance Committee recommends approval of the motion.
Thank you. John Drabinski, Selectman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Moderator. We urge support of this article. It gives the town control, protects our water supply, and it provides access to great conservation land in Mahoney. We unanimously support this article.
Thank you. This motion details the bonding and allocation of categories, which differs in that sense from the warrant articles in your warrant. Anyone wish to be heard on Article 32? Stand up, please. Yep. No. Mike's coming to you.
Arthur Doty, 24 Robbins Road. How comprehensive was the inspection of the site, looking for decades of various chemicals that have been deposited there in an industrial use? Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Basically, the only thing that's been done so far is a visual reconnaissance of the track. We didn't want to spend any money doing any investigation if the town did not want to purchase the property. As I said, we still have to negotiate with CSX. If you vote in favor of this tonight, we will be doing soil testing of the actual rail bed itself. As I said, the water, groundwater testing has already been done in a continuous basis and has shown that there are no contaminants. There's nothing to be concerned about at all in the groundwater. It's tested regularly by our water district. Soil testing will happen. We just didn't want to spend the money if the voters weren't in favor of this.
Thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 32? I see no one. This is a two-thirds vote. All those in favor of Article 32 signify by raising your cards. Thank you. All those opposed? I believe that's a unanimous vote. It passes. We're on to Article 33. It's 1029. We'll move on to Article 33. Mr. Morley. 1029. Hang on. I will ask the hall. Now it is now 10:30. All those in favor of adjourning and coming back tomorrow evening at 7:30, signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? Okay, then we'll move on. Article 33, Mr. Morley.
Article 33, Knobscot Reservation Purchase of Development Rights, Phase 1. Oh, should I address that we're addressing two articles?
Just make the motion, sir.
Okay. Move to approve the recommendation of the Community Preservation Committee to appropriate the sum of $5,545,000 from Community Preservation Act funds for the purpose of purchasing development rights to 160 plus or minus acres of undeveloped land known as the Knobscot Boy Scout Reservation land and lying between Brimstone Lane and Knobscot Road, and for all expenses connected therewith, including bond and note issuance expense. And to raise this appropriation, the Treasurer, with the approval of the Board of Selectmen, is authorized to borrow $5,540,000 under MGL Chapter 44B, Section 11, and MGL Chapter 44, S73, or any other enabling authority that the Board of Selectmen is authorized to take any other action necessary to carry out this project, and that $499,050 be appropriated from the Community Preservation Act funds to pay debt service due on any such bonds or notes. All appropriations shall be allocated to the category of open space, and the appropriation for debt service funded first from open space unrestricted reserves, and second from general unrestricted reserves as necessary. Article 34, Knobscot Reservation Purchase of Development Rights, Phase 2. Move to approve the recommendation of the Community Reservation.
Hang on, you reading 34 now?
Yeah, I was going to.
No, just show it on the view graph. What we're going to do is discuss 33 and 34 together because they're essentially the same topic, but we will, so feel free to discuss either one, but when we come to a vote, we will vote them separately. They each require a two-thirds vote. Mr. Morley, why don't you go on and make the presentation for both articles together.
33 and 34, yes.
Yes, please.
So the first presenter is Jody Kablack, the Director of Planning and Community Development.
Did the motion receive a second? It does.
Good evening, and I apologize for this late time. Although this is a very important article for Sudbury, I will try to keep my comments brief, although I do have approximately 10 minutes of presentation. This is a very complex article. There are a lot of parts to this project, and I want to make sure that the voters of Sudbury know what we're doing here. As I said, this is a very exciting project. Articles 33 and 34 present the town with the most important opportunity regarding open space preservation in Sudbury. The Knobscot Boy Scout Reservation is the largest privately owned parcel of unprotected land in town, and it's one of our most prominent landmarks. The parcel has been a high priority for preservation since the town's first open space plan was written in 1970. State and local attempts of preserving this land have been ongoing for over 10 years, yet this is the first time that we have brought this to town meeting. The town's interest in passing the Community Preservation Act in 2002 was fueled significantly by the desire to protect this parcel and several other parcels of land that had been identified in the town's open space planning efforts for the last three decades. And Mark, if I could get the second slide up. Brief orientation of where Knobscot is. I think everyone knows it's in South Sudbury. It's bordered by Knobscot Road to the east. Route 20 is to the north, and Brimstone Lane roughly is to the west. It is approximately 1 mile east to west and 1 mile north to south. It is 311 acres in Sudbury, which represents 2% of the total land area of the town. This compares to both Great Meadows National Wildlife Refuge and the Assabet River National Wildlife Refuge on both the east and west borders of town. Both of those have just over 500 acres. Next slide. The reservation is 452 acres in total. Again, 311 in Sudbury, and approximately 142 in Framingham. The proposal before you tonight has been negotiated by the Selectmen, the Knox Trail Council, which owns the land, and the Sudbury Valley Trustees.
The Knox Trail Council is a regional nonprofit scouting organization whose headquarters are in Framingham. While an arm of the Boy Scouts of America, the council owns its property, and all proceeds from this transaction will fund its local and regional programs and activities. No funds revert back to the Boy Scouts of America. Knox Trail Council owns the Knobscot Reservation as well as a 300-acre Camp Resolute in Bolton and provides scouting and youth development opportunities for over 7,000 kids in 21 towns in the region. SVT, many of you know, I'm sure, but for the ones that don't, is a regional land trust. It was founded in 1953 and headquarters in Sudbury. They own more than 80 properties in 14 towns, a total of over 2,000 acres. They also hold conservation restrictions on over 1,000 acres, and they've been instrumental in preserving more than 6,000 acres in partnership with public agencies such as the Fish and Wildlife Service, local and state government agencies, and other nonprofit conservation organizations. SVT has over 3,600 members in 36 communities. Those are the players. Let's talk about the proposal. That's great. Many people think that this parcel is already preserved or that the Knox Trail Council will never sell the property, so why pay $8.6 million? Neither of these are the case. The Knox Trail Council, like many nonprofit institutions, faces high operational costs and decreasing income. Maintaining two reservations has been a financial challenge for them. The value of both of their reservations is high. However, Knobscot Reservation does not have the facilities that Camp Resolute has to generate income. Camp Resolute, located right on 495 with its lake and beachfront, provides an active summer recreational camp and generates significantly more income than Knobscot. Knobscot's a lower key facility geared mainly towards non-summer and weekend activities. And in order to maintain their facilities, funds need to be generated. The logical choice is to turn to their major asset to leverage funding. We're fortunate to be working with a board of the Knox Trail Council who values this land and its attributes, and they chose not to sell the property for development, but to work with Sudbury to figure out an alternative to development. A future board may think differently. Therefore, time is of the essence. Now is the time, and we're grateful that they chose preservation over development. We may not get this opportunity again. You may also wonder why the town doesn't buy the land outright and develop it for commercial use or to raise revenue. First, the property is not being offered to us for sale. It's the current council's desire to keep the scout camp operating in order to provide the programs that they offer, and this deal has been structured that way. If we were discussing outright sale, the price would be closer to $12.6 million. Second, the funds available for this project do not allow purchase and then sale for anything other than the CPA purposes, open space, housing, historic preservation. In order to purchase this for any other use, the town would need to vote an override. Third, the area along Knobscot Road, which would be the most appropriate for any type of commercial development, is almost entirely wetlands. The more developable area is at the higher elevations, a considerable distance back from the road. No, go back. That's the point, the other point. What is being offered is the recording of a permanent conservation restriction on 303 acres of the reservation that are located in Sudbury. A conservation restriction is a legal means authorized under the Mass General Laws to limit the use of land in order to protect specified conservation values, including natural, scenic, or open conditions. The conservation restriction will prevent development of the property into a subdivision or a commercial use, such as a shopping center or offices, but will allow continuation of the scout camp as long as it protects the natural environment. And I'll refer to the conservation restriction, I'll refer to it as a CR from now. That's what I mean, that's the restriction. The CR will be placed on all the land the council owns in Sudbury, less approximately 8 acres. Mark, does this have a laser printer, a laser pointer? Yeah. Is it this one? The red one, okay. There's 8 acres that's labeled as exclusion land on the map. And the CR will be divided into two distinct portions of the property. The open space zone, which contains 160 acres, and is generally located in the northwestern portion of the property. This is the area that has very little camp facilities. Tippling Rock is located in this area, and there are a lot of trails here. Those trails connect to two town-owned conservation lands, the Weisbrot property and the Brimstone conservation areas. The remaining 140 acres, which is more of this area, contains the scout camp, and we refer to that as the program zone. And the CR divides these into two sections due to particular uses that will be allowed in each area, and I'll describe those in a few minutes. This plan also shows the 145 acres of the reservation in Framingham down here, which is not the subject of this town meeting, but which we have committed along with the town of Framingham and SVT to working towards its eventual preservation at a future date. Again, I say that the desire of the Knox Trail Council is to preserve this entire property. The plan also shows a 4.5 acre out parcel of land right here in the middle, which belongs to a local family and will remain in private ownership for the time being. The owners, we've approached them. They're not ready to sell this property at this time. However, we will try to continue to preserve this property by incorporating it into the restriction at a future date when they are willing to sell. The plan includes two 4-acre parcels in yellow, one here and one here. These two parcels will also be excluded from the CR. The northernmost parcel contains 4 rental homes that are owned by the Knox Trail Council and will remain there. The southernmost parcel contains the main camp entrance, the parking lot, White Lodge, and the Ranger's House. And that area is so developed that it wasn't really worthy of protection. The frontage along Knobscot Road will have some restrictions in the conservation restriction to protect the streetscape and to not allow a removal of significant vegetation in that area. The provisions of the CR will guarantee that the reservation remains essentially as it is in perpetuity. The council will retain ownership to the land and will continue to run the scout camp. The CR will prohibit typical residential and commercial development in perpetuity. It will allow the scouting and camping activity in accordance with the current programs. And there will be provisions for maintenance, repair, reconstruction, and limited new construction within the program zone. Again, here, the active camp area. The provisions in the open space zone are more stringent. Like any other typical CR, will allow little disturbance other than trail maintenance and clearing for vistas at Tippling Rock. The land will stay essentially as it is now. A very important part of the CR is the requirement that the property be open to the public for passive recreation. There are many trails and interpretive areas showcasing the history and the natural resources of the property. The Bay Circuit Trail, which is a 200-mile-long trail along a beltway from Plum Island to Duxbury, crosses the property and will remain open in perpetuity to the public.
Ms. Cablack, about how long?
About 4 minutes.
Can you speak fast?
I thought that we had 20 minutes since we were talking about both articles.
I apologize. You're right.
Great.
But you're not going to go 20 minutes,
five
right?
Minutes. The Knox Trail Council has been generous in allowing the public to access this land for many years. However, we have no legal right to access the land. These legal rights will now be secured in perpetuity. Visitors will be subject to the council's practical rules and regulations for the safety of all visitors, as they are currently when you do approach the property. The council will retain the right to close the property to the public during major scouting events. This is necessary for the safety of the campers. There are occasions up there where they have over 200 campers, and they will need to close the main entrances to the property during those events. However, there will be alternative access available and parking through the adjacent Sudbury Conservation Lands, which connect to the reservation, and there will be hiking in the open space zone during that time. The town of Sudbury and Sudbury Valley Trustees will jointly hold the CR. SVT will be the primary managing agent, though, and they will be responsible and will take this on for monitoring and enforcing the provisions of the restriction, and this eliminates future costs to the town. The town will not have to do this monitoring and enforcement. Next slide. Sorry. I'm going to talk just briefly about the value of the property and the price and how we arrived at that. The cost for the CR has been derived by reviewing property appraisals to determine its value for development. This is how we always determine value for lands that we buy for open space. Both the Knox Trail Council and the town commissioned their own appraisals, and the average of the two was the basis for all of our negotiations. The property was thoroughly evaluated for its development potential, which, although seems challenging due to slopes and soil conditions, was clearly capable of significant development. on the 311 acres in Sudbury, the value of the land was derived for its potential for 47 single-family lots. And this plan shows the entire build-out of the 452 acres, 47 lots in Sudbury, 36 lots in Framingham. And this plan complies with all zoning and subdivision regulations of both towns. The appraisals reflect present-day comparable land sales and include development costs and the time value of the sale of a large subdivision over 7 to 10 years. The estimated average value of the Sudbury land is just under $12 million, and the CR price at $8.6 million reflects a 28% discount. This discounted pricing represents a considerable value to the town and compares very favorably with other open space acquisitions in the recent past. Next slide. On the screen is a comparison of other recent open space purchases, with Knobscot showing less than one half the average cost on a per lot basis and only one quarter the cost on a per acre basis. Reviewing this slide also reminds us that over the past 15 years, the town has purchased over 250 acres of land for open space, reducing the total number of residential building lots by 71. With Knobscot, we will increase these numbers to over 550 acres and less 118 lots. Sudbury's open space preservation efforts have prevented otherwise developable land from being turned into subdivisions and has reduced municipal and school costs in perpetuity. Next slide. The transaction has been structured in two payments, and that's the reason why we have two articles. $6.6 million will be paid if these articles pass in 2008, and $2 million will be paid in 2011. In total, the town will be responsible for $7.5 million of the total price, with SVT taking up the additional $1.1 million. We will be applying for a state self-help grant in July, which, if granted, will reduce the town's $7.5 million price tag by $500,000. In our negotiations with the Knox Trail Council, we will be closing on this property in November or December, and that's due to the fact that the grant award won't be notified until then, and by state law, we're not allowed to close on the property until we receive notification of the grant. And then phase two payment will be delayed until 2011. This delay in payment was a good point for the town because it's twofold. It allows the town and the CPC budget to recover from the large expenditure in 2009, which is the first payment, thereby allowing that CPC budget to recover and be able to use the CPC funds for all the other projects. It will also allow the CPC to keep this additional $2 million payment in an account which earns interest and goes back to the town. As Mr. Morley spoke earlier, this expenditure does not increase your taxes, nor will it increase your CPA surcharge. That will remain the same. Funds that are currently collected and allocated to the fund will be used for the bonding of this. We acknowledge that this is a significant investment, but the CPC has been tracking this project for several years, planning accordingly. And allowing for this proposal will also allow for the continued function of the CPA for future projects, as the statute allows. This project represents an extraordinary collaboration of resources by all the parties involved, and the level of commitment to preserving community character and assets in Sudbury is noteworthy. We're pleased to partner with SVT on this project. They've provided invaluable expertise in land protection, and they're currently conducting a precedent-setting private fundraising campaign to provide an infusion of funds to the project. To date, they've raised nearly 80% of their goal, over $1 million. We also want to thank the Sudbury Foundation for their generous financial support of this project and their commitment to furthering Sudbury's master plan goals of preserving the town's natural, historic, and community assets. And we forged a relationship with the Knox Trail Council, which will now be intertwined in perpetuity in our guardianship of this project. The project is supported by the Board of Selectmen, the Community Preservation Committee, the Finance Committee, the Planning Board, the Conservation Commission, and the Sudbury Historical Commission. And I'm going to turn the rest of the presentation over to Debbie Deneen, the town's conservation coordinator, and she will highlight the ecological aspects of the property which make this such a unique project. Thank you.
Hello again. Okay. You've heard from Mr. Morley from the CPC and our planning director, Jody Kablak, about all the legal motion, the legal funding details, the details of the purchase. I'm not here to talk about any of that with you tonight. I'm here to talk about what my husband, Steve Meyer, called the tingle factor. And that's when you weigh all the facts. You take all the pros and you take all the cons, and when you put it all together, it just doesn't matter because you get a gut feeling. This is one of those opportunities. This is something that just is a gut feeling about this place. So basically, I'm here to make you tingle, which is tough to do at this hour. I hope a lot of you here took advantage of going out and taking advantage of the walks that the Boy Scouts gave. You would get a feel for the mountain. I hope you've had a chance to experience it. In case you didn't, my presentation is going to be to bring the mountain to you. First thing is, you've heard it, Knobscot Mountain. We all refer to it as Knobscot Mountain, but if you look at any of the national U.S. Geological Survey maps, it's always called a hill. Well, let USGS call it what it wants. To us, it's our mountain. That's what it is. It's only 600 feet above sea level, but it has been a very, very prominent landscape feature for all the inhabitants of Sudbury in the past and in the future. All the inhabitants have also recognized the importance of Knobscot. Knobscot means land of falling rock. Don't let that stop you from going out there. Really, truly, the falling rock zone is in Framingham. Okay. I put a couple of landmarks on this map to show you. What I'm going to do is put the property into context. So here you can see Knobscot Road. You can see the entrance to the Boy Scout land. You can see the lodge. And way in the back, you can see Dupsey Pond, which is one of the nice features on the site. Here again, we're circling by air the property. 30 Rod Road is the main cart path through the property. Again, you can see Nupsey Pond. In the background of the picture, you can see the Sudbury Tippling Rock Trail conservation land. And you start to see the beginning of Tippling Rock in your lower left. As we continue around, you get a few more Thank you. Okay. Good. My neck doesn't hurt. Okay. You can see, you can start to see a few more landmarks. You can see Longfellow Glen at the top of your screen. Again, you can see Tippling Rock, and you can start to see how prominent that really is in the landscape. And you can also see Boston Coast Road way in the back.
Ms. Deneen, could you tell me approximately how much longer you're going to be?
3 minutes.
We're going to have to run through these pictures a little bit more because unless you want to do it by candlelight, the lights get shut off at a certain hour.
Okay. Okay, Horse Pond Road, Tippling Rock. Stone Tavern Farm Fields in the background, Tippling Rock. Another view of Tippling Rock as we come around. You can see how in the background you saw all the development and how such a short distance away it becomes wilderness area. A little bit further back out, you can start to see Brimstone Lane off in your west and Boston Post Road to your north. This, I think, is a much more boring picture of it, but it gives you an idea of where some of the abutting properties are. I think Jody showed you this. Okay. Here are some of the critters that you might not notice live out there, but they're out there. So this is not just a purchase for people to go walk on, but it's also home for a lot of our animals and plants. Again, we can't stop showing you the development plan because it's a real plan developed by a real engineering firm based on real on-site conditions. This was taken on our walk last Sunday,
And as you can see, here's a lot of people, despite the fact that it was cold and a little drizzly at times. We got a great opportunity to get out on the property and experience it, and I hope everyone in this room has that same opportunity. Okay. Scout Camp, since 1928. This picture was taken, I believe, around circa 1932, as was this one. This property has been enriching the youth of this community and many, many surrounding communities since that time. This is a bridge that they built in 1932. This is a bridge, 2008. Not much has changed out there. I'm going to talk just very briefly about how this purchase will be a long-term reduction in taxes. Yeah, I said reduction. It's not something you hear very often. How so? Well, if you go back to the development slide, which I won't do now because I think you've got it etched in your brain at this point, 47 new houses, septic systems, driveways, cars, in-ground sprinklers, and, of course, kids. You can do the math. Two kids per house, 94 kids, 20 kids in a classroom, on and on and on. What's beautiful about land purchases is instead of being a never-ending drain on financial resources that go on indefinitely, once the land is paid for, that's it. Land is a forever commodity. It will always be there. It's always harder to come by than it was the day before, and it's always increasing in value over the long run. I do want to mention that there are 12 miles of well-marked trails, including the Bay Circuit Trail through the property. And I'm not going to read the whole list of all the different types of species of trees. There's a lot of them. There are mountain streams, vernal pools, state-listed species, hawks, owls, lots of birds. I think I'd rather end right now with a very short slideshow, and I want to just briefly explain how I came about with this. I was just doing a search on Google about Knobscot Mountain, and I ran into a song called Knobscot Lullaby. This song was written by a gentleman.
Ms. Deneen, we have to cut it off. We're done.
Okay.
Ms. Deneen wishes to tell you to support the article. Jim Jacobson from...
I just wanted to play a one-minute thing, but if people don't want to see it...
No, I can't.
You don't know what you're missing, but okay.
Jim Jacobson from the Finance Committee.
The Finance Committee strongly recommends approval of the motion. I won't sing to you, but I will give you a few immediate and short bullet points. The property is spectacular. If anyone's walked there and considered losing it, it's anathema to them. One of the few places I can think of to take my dog hiking. I have come to Sudbury 7 years ago from Washington, D.C., and seen what happens when you start developing this type of parcel to the umpteenth, and it's really a tragedy. The alternative here is 33 houses. You've seen that. There's building plans for it. The strain on the schools will increase. I don't know if you can expect, you know, two kids per house, because we're talking about potentially very big, very expensive homes. Perhaps the most important thing is no new taxes, and the money's there. I mean, that to me is the no-brainer. Finally, a lot of that money is matched from the state and CPA funds, among other sources that are not coming out of your pocket. And finally, the bonding, I think you may have heard, extends the burden beyond just one group of taxpayers, so that you've got future residents also contributing and also enjoying it. Leave it at that.
Thank you. John Drabinski for the Selectmen.
Thank you, Mr. Moderator. In my opening comments to you last night, I called this place a treasure, and it clearly is a treasure. This parcel really helps define the sense of place in Sudbury. And I want to take this opportunity to thank the Knox Trail and Sudbury Valley trustees and working with the Board of Selectmen to make this happen. This has been a long negotiation between the three parties in more than 5 years. So the Board of Selectmen is strongly, strongly passionate about this parcel, and we strongly urge your support to protect this unique place. Please support this. Thank you.
Anybody wish to be heard on Article 33? Yes, on the side there. I'm going to ask each of you as you speak, as I cut off Ms. Dineen, if each of you could keep the comment fairly short, because I was serious about the lights being cut off shortly after 11:30 here.
Robert Stein, 7 Thompson Drive. I'll keep it under 1 hour. Just some quick questions that I do have. If this is a bonding issue, and it is spread out over 20 years, could you please tell us the total cost of the purchase of the land over the 20 years, number one. Number two, could you please then divide that by the average home? Number three, does this lock us into CPA 3% tax for 20 years? And if it doesn't, and if, say, two or three years down the road we decide to get rid of the CPA, does this now become an obligation of the town and the taxpayers? Number four, can you just tell us, give us some color of exactly how many Sudbury residents use this property on a weekly basis, monthly basis, year, just so we can get an idea of how many people actually use it.
Thank you. Who wishes to take the interest question? Right here, Mr. Morley.
I'm not sure I'll be able to answer or remember what all those questions were, although we've had millions of meetings and hearings on this. I will say that the bonding that we do on all land purchases, as I described earlier in detail, does obligate the town to repay the bonds. We manage our money so that all those bonds can be repaid with the CPA surcharge. But indeed, if for some reason people chose to get rid of CPA and say no to the matching funds from the state, the town would be obligated to pay those bonds until they're paid off. The total cost is to us is $7 million and about $3 million more over 20 years in bonding costs. I think those were the two main points.
And divided by the number of houses in Sudbury?
What? $1,200 over 20 years.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 33? Do we know how many people use the property?
As was mentioned several times.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stein.
We're all set. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 33 or Article 34? Hang on 1 second. It's just too early. Gentlemen right here, stand up, please.
Jan Hardenberg, 7 Tipling Rock Road. Given the hour, I'm not going to say my little spiel, but we are given the chance to make a permanent contribution to the town of Sudbury. And I've been up Tipling Rock many times, and it's hard to believe that if you've been up there on a clear day that you would vote against this. And so I tell you, if you have any doubt whatsoever about this article, that you vote yes tonight, and I will guide you up to Tipling Rock on a clear day, and you will forever know that you made the right choice.
Anybody else wish to be heard on Articles 33 or 34? Right here. Yes, ma'am. Stand up, please.
Jennifer Pincus, 25 Blueberry Hill Lane. I'm all for this. I just had a clarification on Article 33 and Article 34 are Phase 1 and Phase 2. Is there any requirement to vote yes on both, or can we vote yes on Article 34 and not 33? And I'm wondering what the access to the Phase 1 area is should they decide to not develop the Phase 2 area. Can they actually get to the Phase 1 area to develop that area separately?
Mr. Morley?
I'm not sure that we would go for the $5 million one and not go for the $2 million one, but the Phase 1, which is the $5 million one, is a budding conservation land that's off of Brimstone Lane, so it would have access. This isn't the scouts are not offering us either. They're offering us both. So if one does fail, we would have to go back to them and renegotiate. Did I cover them, Jennifer? Anything else? Okay.
Thank you. Anyone else wish to be heard? Yes, gentleman over there.
Alan Williamson, Barton Drive, 131 Barton Drive. Many years ago, some old person somewhere down the line voted some money from a town and put some money aside for some land so that people could be in scouting. And next year, I'll be in scouting 50 years. So if any of you elderly people in some other towns voted for money so that I could be a Boy Scout, thanks a lot.
Gentleman on the aisle. Right here, Boy Scout, right here, standing up. Thank you.
John Sklenick, 93 Robbins Road. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Conservation Commission. I just want to run through a few slides here very quickly for you.
Don't do it. John, the groans that you're hearing mean that you should do it very, very quickly.
I can get this thing functioning. Tonight, you have a rather unique opportunity. My research indicates that never before has the town had the opportunity and the ability to permanently preserve approximately 300 acres of prime undeveloped land. Now, we talked about 47 lots. It could be more.
He's done. Sit down.
Do you want to smile and proudly tell your children that you're part of the reason why Knobscot Mountain remains undeveloped? Or would you prefer to sheepishly admit that you're part of the reason why the mountain is draped with clusters of houses? The Conservation Commission unanimously supports Articles 33 and 34.
Thank you. Hang on. Anybody else wish to be heard on Article 33? Question's been called. Do I hear a second? I do. All those in favor of the call of the question signify by raising your cards. All those opposed? It passes. We're going to vote separately, first on Article 33. It requires a two-thirds vote because of the borrowing, also because it's a purchase. Either one of those reasons requires a two-thirds vote. All those in favor of Article 33 signify by raising your cards. All those opposed, it gets well more than two-thirds. We're now going to move on to Article 34. A motion, please.
I just have to read the motion. We don't have to discuss it anymore. Phase two, move to approve the recommendation of the Community Preservation Committee to appropriate the sum of $2,040,000 from Community Preservation Act funds to be used in conjunction with the funds appropriated under Article 33 of this 2008 annual town meeting for the purpose of purchasing development rights to an additional 143 plus or minus acres known as the Knobscot Scott Reservation land and line adjacent to 1 Knobscot Road to be conveyed to the town and the Sudbury Valley trustees in FY09 with payment therefore to be made for the amounts appropriated under this article no later than June 30, 2011, and for all expenses connected therewith, including bond and note issuance expense, and to raise this appropriation, the treasurer, with the approval of the Board of Selectmen, is authorized to borrow $2,040,000 under MGL Chapter 44B, Section 11, and MGL Chapter 44, Section 7, Subsection 3, or any other enabling authority, but the Board of Selectmen is authorized to take any other action necessary to carry out this project. All appropriations shall be allocated to the category of open space and the appropriation for debt service funded first from open space restricted reserves, and second from general unrestricted reserves as necessary.
Does that receive a second? It does. Mr. Morley, stay here, please. For those of us who couldn't follow quite as fast as you read, I understand that. Is the essential difference between Article 33 and 34 the dollar amount, as well as the date for 2011? And other than that, they're substantially the same?
Yes, they are.
Thank you. Anybody wish to discuss Article 34? I see no one. All those in favor of Article 34 signify by raising your cards. Those opposed? It is nearly unanimous. It passes. Do I hear a motion to adjourn to tomorrow night at 7:30? Is there a second? All those in favor, all those opposed, meeting's adjourned till tomorrow.